I should point out that this entire podcast was AI generated and none of us were actually here.
Alternative rock staged a coup on mainstream music in the 1990s, but by the end of that decade, the fires of grunge were extinguished and the burgeoning indie scene mostly suppressed by a new vanguard of overly sexualized teenage pop stars and boy bands. Pop had reasserted itself on the radio and video airwaves, and I wasn't with it. By the late 90s, my early high school years, I knew what kind of music got my blood pumping, but suddenly, it wasn't all around me. I had to search for it. Thus, I began a musical odyssey of rock and roll antiquity that would take me to Andy Warhol's factory with the Velvet Underground, to the sweaty bowels of CBGB's with Blondie, to raucous stadiums with The Who, to wherever you find Bob Dylan. This quest would continue throughout college, where I'd shack up with Bruce Springsteen, Hart, and Neil Diamond, and have one-night stands with The Clash, The Cars, and The Faces, all eventually leading to my true love, Tom Waits. But along the way, I found myself at a musical crossroads. The Beatles or the Rolling Stones? Growing up in the house of Patrick Daly, I had heard a fair share of both groups, though if forced, I would say Dad probably played more Beatles around the house than the Stones. This, however, was countered by the seemingly never-ending slew of Rolling Stones songs appearing on the soundtracks to some of my favorite movies at the time. Jumpin' Jack Flash in 1998's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Paint It Black in the same year's Stir of Echoes, Fool to Cry in 1996's Beautiful Girls, Gimme Shelter, as well as like five other Rolling Stones songs in Scorsese's Casino. Not to mention Guns N' Roses covering Sympathy for the Devil as the credits rolled in Interview with the Vampire, and Townes Van Zandt covering Dead Flowers at the end of The Big Lebowski. But then, you know, there was Ferris Bueller hijacking a parade to sing Twist and Shout, so the question persisted. The Beatles or the Rolling Stones? I went on dates with both. I was impressed by both, but I only had chemistry with one of them. I told the Beatles, "It's not you, it's me," and I meant that. The Beatles were Superman, otherworldly talented, as radiant and powerful as the sun, always there, soaring above us, a shining example of the greatness we could achieve if we stretched a little farther. By obvious contrast, the Rolling Stones were Batman. They worked after hours. They were street level, covered in sweat and grime and someone else's blood. The Stones, like the Dark Knight Detective, reflected not grace and perfection, but rather a bruised and battered soul that, regardless of injury, would never stop fighting. Inspired by Muddy Waters and other blues legends, the Rolling Stones formed in London, 1962, playing America's catalog of R&B and soul standards. When singer Mick Jagger and guitarist Keith Richards began writing their own material, though, they formed a creative partnership that has endured for six decades, charting countless radio hits and shaping the landscape of rock and roll forever. Last year, 62 years and 25 albums after they first came together, the Rolling Stones released their latest record of new material, Hackney Diamonds. When I started listening to the Stones, I thought I was excavating some ancient relics of rock and roll's past. A couple decades later, not only are they still at the forefront of popular music's present, I am now convinced that Mick and Keith will outlive us all and continue dropping bangers from our Martian colony in the far future. And I bet they'll still sound as good. Hello, and welcome to an exciting new episode of Fire and Water Records, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly, and joining me to discuss what is possibly the greatest rock and roll band of all time, the greatest group of guest hosts I could ever assemble. You've heard them on the show before. Please welcome Omar Uden. What's up, Omar?
Hey, Ryan. Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Tom Panarese. What's going on, Tom?
We're doing well. How are you guys?
Good. And finally, my semi-permanent ride or die, Neil Daly. What's up, bro?
What's up, guys? Happy to be here.
Alrighty. For this episode, we are not just going to discuss our favorite songs one at a time like we do for a lot of episodes. Instead, this will be a more open-ended discussion about our history with the band, what we think separates them from other rock artists, are they still relevant after all this time, and then before the end, we will certainly catalog some of our favorite Stones tracks. So I gave my answer, but then how did you guys discover the Rolling Stones? Tom, you get the question first.
The funny thing is the Stones, like kind of like the Beatles and other bands that are that much in the pantheon of rock and roll, I more than likely heard about them or heard of them before I even started listening to them. Being born in the late 70s and growing up in the 80s, the Stones were very well established by then. So probably heard the first song I probably heard was probably I Can't Get No Satisfaction. I cannot tell you what context, probably on the oldies radio station my mom used to play. My first exposure to a lot of their hits, the songs that are really well known, is through a pretty unlikely source. In 1989, Weird Al Yankovic put out the UHF soundtrack, and on the UHF soundtrack is the Hot Rocks Polka. So my introduction to a list of Rolling Stones songs were polka covers by Weird Al. And I listened to a lot of classic rock radio in high school. I would borrow CDs. I would tape stuff. My roommate in college, Dennis, had like not only a bunch of Stones CDs, but he had several of the albums on record, including Sticky Fingers with the zipper. And it just kind of went from there. And I've kind of on and off over the years, there are times where I'll listen to the group, especially in the streaming era, where I can just kind of pick up what I want to pick up and listen to something all the way through without having to, you know, go and get it. And then there are complete lulls where I don't really listen to them at all. But yeah, so that's kind of how it started.
Omar, how and when did you get into the Rolling Stones?
The Rolling Stones had always sort of ambiently been in the background of my awareness of popular music. But I think I was affected pretty early on as a junior high and high school and college student with this notion of them as sort of like an aging traveling circus that had sort of long since sold out on any preconceived, you know, artistic integrity. You know, they were more of a brand by the time I was coming into my musical awareness than anything else. I also had bought into and we can talk about this later, utterly fake choice that was presented to me that you talked about like, are you a Beatles person or are you a Stones person? And I pretty early on, because of the influence of friends, I just think their cultural ubiquity had latched onto the Beatles. And I think subconsciously I relegated the Rolling Stones to the ash heap of history. And it was only later on, and I distinctly remember it was the summer before my first year of law school, I settled down, I sat down with a proper Rolling Stones record. And I think I was with you, Ryan. I was driving into Chicago for some reason with you. I don't remember what we were doing, but you were playing the Let It Bleed record. And it was I had this kind of ambient awareness that, you know, the Stones golden age, like kind of involved the Let It Be record. It was that classic era of theirs. But that was the first time that I really gave conscious thought and focus to the track by track experience. I had heard some of the songs. I mean, Ryan, you mentioned the Martin Scorsese soundtrack experience. You bring up Casino, but they have been prominently featured in, you know, like Goodfellas and The Departed as well. But that was the first time I actually sat with it and gave it my whole attention. And it was, I think I was driving with you, it was in your car. And like,
I think you got a new apartment in Chicago or somewhere out there. And I was going to see you. So we were driving around. And
right.
It might have been Let It Bleed. I think it was a mix CD that I'd made of like just called from their greatest hits or like
it
their
might have been. What I distinctly remember from that experience is that those opening sort of shimmering sounds of Gimme Shelter, which is just one of the most haunting, you know, audio experiences you can ever have. And that day left an impression with me. And so like my first semester of law school, which is like probably one of the most, understandably, like one of the most stress laden experiences of my life, the soundtrack of those 4 or 5 months, what got me through the classes and what got me through acclimating to a new city and my friend and meeting new friends and final exams was the Rolling Stones catalog. Like I went all in. After that, I went and bought Let It Bleed. I went and bought Beggar's Banquet and Sticky Fingers and Exile on a Main Street. I bought the 40 Licks DVD, which had come out the year before, so I could get a sense of, you know, them as a live band. And it really threw the shackles off of me in terms of the preconceived notions I had of them as this traveling circus. And I just spent more time with them and I became absolutely obsessed. And it really taught me to sort of deny the false binary presented to me of, are you a Beatles person or are you a Stones person? It really made me appreciate the milieu, the artistic milieu and songwriting milieu that like they were playing in, this idea that like, oh my God, these guys mainstreamed blues music in America. And like, I've been obsessed ever since. And I understand like your mileage may vary. It's a long discography. It's very much like Dylan in the sense of like, not everything is going to be a home run. Not everything is necessarily going to be even a double or a triple, but like, oh man, when the stuff is good, it sings. And so like in the ensuing 20 years, they became one of my five favorite, not just bands, but musical artists of all time. That's why I'm, you know, so stoked to be able to talk about him today.
And I considered myself doing paying you back for getting me into you too.
Well, there you go. There, so. Quid pro quo. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Neil, what is your origin story with the Rolling Stones?
Surprisingly, it's the exact same as Omar's. No.
The law school part.
Minus that. I do. Part of me wants to see if like the UHF soundtrack could ever make our perfect album list. Like I kind of want to do, and all I picture is John Candy in Home Alone now talking about polka, polka, polka. Like, hey, we're big in Sheboygan, you know? Okay. So like most of us, I shouldn't say like most of us, like Ryan, as you're familiar with, we were introduced to almost all music by our dad. That part mirrors, my story's going to mirror yours to a certain extent. Correct me if I'm wrong though, Ryan, I always kind of felt like mom might have been a little bit more of a Beatles fan and dad was a little more Stones. I know we played them, I know they were both kind of omnipresent in the house, but that was my memory of it. And I could be wrong, or maybe that's my memory before.
That could be true. I remember hearing more Beatles in the house when I was growing up, but
okay.
Dad seems more like a Rolling Stones type than Beatles.
Yeah. And I wanted to kind of touch on that because in my impression, and this goes back, and this could very well be before you were born too. Mm-hmm. Like this is in our, when the stereo was in the living room on Delcy Drive kind of thing. I thought the Stones were more of a guitar rock band, you know, more of a garage rock band kind of thing than the Beatles were. And they were like the cleaner pop band. So maybe my memory is a little colored by that impression. But I thought Dad was more of a Stones guy than Beatles. What I do remember is the Hot Rocks collection, the 64 to 71 collection, being out of the jacket of the vinyl LP jacket. And leaning against the stereo, Ryan, I'm sure you have that memory. You know, our dad had custom built a stereo shelf unit that housed all of his records underneath. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've talked about this in prior podcasts, but music was much more present in our house than the TV was. So there were records playing all the time. And I remember coming home after school or getting up in the morning or something. There was always the last album that was being played was out and the jacket was out so you could look through it and, you know, see this track list and all the stuff. But I remember that collection being in regular rotation. And because it was a greatest hits double album, every song was good from my memory. Every single song was good. So I really didn't equate that. You know, I was probably too young to recognize that that's a greatest hits album, not just an album, but every song was great. The first time I discovered them more on my own, meaning not influenced by our dad, was, and I remember this pretty well, when Tattoo You came out and MTV was in its infancy and picked up the videos for Start Me Up and Hang Fire. Mm-hmm. Those two were played like crazy. And they were great. First of all, they're great rock tracks by themselves. But I vividly remember watching those videos and how cheap they were. Of all the bands back then, they were sitting in like a black studio with like no special effects or nothing. And my memory was, why does Mick Jagger make such weird faces when he sings? And then, which overtook that memory, I remember like asking Dad, why do the drummer and the bass player look like they don't want to be there? that was constantly my memory. Now, last thing I'm going to say is right around that same time. So we're talking probably 81-ish. Right around that same time, there was a concert movie that came out called Let's Spend the Night Together. And it was two live shows from the 1981 tour that were combined into one concert video, but they were from two different shows. And it was a kick-ass, amazing set list. And I remember Mick Jagger wearing NFL pants, like football pants, knickers, and then had like a Jets jersey when they were playing at like in Giant Stadium or whatever. And then Keith Richards smoking the whole time and kind of only playing when he wanted to. And that was they just had this coolness about them. And it was, the songs were catchy, the songs were great. That's what attracted me to them. But that was the first time I had this visual of these guys I just thought they were cool. And I was hooked from that. Let's spend the night together. Now I need you more than ever.
Let's spend the night together now. Because none of us were contemporary when the band was starting, a lot of us kind of grew up thinking about this band that had this sort of mythical status already.
Yeah.
And I just kind of want to talk about, like, where did that status come from? Is it earned? Is it justified? Like, what do you think separates the Rolling Stones from other rock bands, either of that era or bands that came later? And like, do they deserve their place in the pantheon of like rock and roll legends or gods or something like that? Like, Omar, what do you think?
Yeah, I think they do. But I think, listen, if it was just based on the acumen of the songwriting and the quality of the records they put out, they would make it. They would make that short list of the greatest groups of all time. What I think, though, that makes them transcendent is not just the quality from a substantive standpoint, but also they were a group that, and I would put the Beatles in this category. I would put like the Who and U2 in this category. There has always been a reticence among bands in particular, artists in general, but bands in particular, that to sort of equate artistic integrity with hiding from the limelight a little bit. And the Rolling Stones were, you know, one of the first big groups to, and they pioneered this idea of them as a brand. They had no problem putting themselves out there. I mean, one of the great criticisms I have, and if this is not very original, because I'm, you know, there are a lot of people that have brought this up, one of the great criticisms of musicians of, you know, the post-war era is that pop musicians of the post-war era is so many of them, you know, the bands are reluctant to give you anything about their persona other than like their street level. And the Rolling Stones were like, no, screw that. We're a brand. Like, we're a band and we're a brand. And we are a brand that will change and, you know, adjust to the times. Sometimes they would do that less successfully. I mean, I'm thinking of like the early and mid 80s Emotional Rescue. Wait, no, not Emotional Rescue. I don't even remember the records they did in the mid 80s that almost drove them permanently apart before the Steel Wheels reunion. But like, that stuff was grim, but it never stopped them from just like moving along. And I think that while they still have artistic integrity, they have artistic integrity because the quality of their best songwriting is so much better than just about everyone else. But they've never been reticent about putting themselves out there. So I think it's marketing and fearlessness combined with the quality of the work, combined with the fact that like the songs weren't just good, but they pioneered, you know, like a form of, you know, a ghettoized form of music and made it mainstream. So because they were firing on all these cylinders from a substantive songwriting standpoint and from a marketing standpoint, I think that's why they earned their place in the pantheon. If it was just based on the songs, like, I think they would be there anyway, but this is what puts them like first among equals.
Yeah, and you talked about what they did with this sort of genre of music and how they brought it to the mainstream. Like, I've always thought of them perfecting this kind of cross-pollination of blues, honky-tonk, R&B, and like soul in a way that didn't seem like these were white guys culturally appropriating a different race's music or different group's music.
Yeah.
That never, to me, like seemed like it was an issue. Now, like, that if they were starting today, maybe we would think about that differently. But
no, in the same way that like I give the Beastie Boys a pass, because even though like it could seem like cultural appropriation, there is such clearly a reverence for what they do and such clearly like a meticulousness to the way they pay homage and build off of, you know, the actual rap music that they're studying, that they're building upon. I say the same thing about the Rolling Stones. Like, they would be, I mean, I guess if you nitpicked, you could accuse them of cultural appropriation, but like you can tell how much reverence they have for the art form, you know? It's like very evident from the get-go. And they fused all these concepts together as you're talking about. And it's funny. And again, one of my hobby horses during this episode is going to be to attempt to sort of push back against this idea that the binary choice is you're either a Beatles person or a Stones person. Like, I don't like that conception in general, but like, I would go a step further and say, man, if you're going to make anything a binary in terms of like contemporary bands that were trying to do something, I wouldn't use the Beatles. I would use Led Zeppelin, because Led Zeppelin was still like trying to play within the blues wheelhouse. And if you're someone that likes to, you know, go all in on this blues, you know, rock hybrid, I can see why Led Zeppelin would be appealing. What made the Rolling Stones and what makes the Rolling Stones more appealing to me is that they fit all that stuff within like a pop context in like a better way, a better, more accessible way than a band like Led Zeppelin did. So, but you're right. Like, they were doing like four or five different things. And they did it not shamelessly, but like in a totally unself-conscious way that made me think that like, yeah, these are blues guys. Whereas someone like Eric Clapton strikes me as like, he can say he's a blues guitarist at heart all he wants, but I'm just like, yeah, you're trying too hard. I can see the wheels turning. With the Stones, I never got that sense. You're not strong, and you're so sweet.
You make me hard, you make me weak. Neil, as a musician, I want your take on your thought about like how you define the sound of the band, as well as the previous question of like what kind of separates them, what makes them a cut above or a cut separate from these other rock and roll legends.
Sure. Well, Omar's actually right. There's a lot that a lot of things that Omar said that I draw from. Like, for example, okay, bear with me with this tangent. Go with me on this journey for a second. If Elvis, who was kind of aping the songs of Little Richard and Chuck Berry and stuff like that, going those type of black soul songs from the South, if Elvis wouldn't have gone off on this tangent to be in show tunes and do the Vegas stuff, like he might have gone the direction the Stones went. Like I see the Stones less in competition to the Beatles, like Omar said, as I do more to them, like doing like Little Richard and Chuck Berry. That kind of sound. So, there's just a, you know, Ryan, you and I have discussed this before in the past. One of the things that, if people were to ask me about like the Beatles, just about the Beatles, and I'm not a huge Beatles fan, I respect them, but I'm not a huge fan of them. You and I have discussed at great length before, one of our favorite fabricated Beatles albums was the Backbeat movie soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Which was when the Beatles were a garage rock band. Mm-hmm. And they play, you know, it was sweaty and dirty playing in bars and that kind of thing. And they were playing all the black tunes, all the, the R&B of the time. Yeah. And that's what that album, if that was ever actually a Beatles album, I would have loved it. That was the sound that I liked sonically.
Right.
The Stones did that. The Stones picked up that mantle and played that. They were that. They were sweaty and dirty and, you know, where the Beatles might have been the clean cut pop, you know, New Kids on the Block kind of thing. The Stones were more like New Edition with Bobby Brown getting in trouble at, that kind of thing. So sonically, to answer the first part of your question, I would say, yeah, that was it. I think it was just that it was a dirty, bluesy rock that they created charted their own path. You know, again, Omar is very, very accurate with his description that Led Zeppelin's early years were, they were trying to copy somebody else's sound. Whereas the Stones kind of charted their own course. You know, they did a bunch of covers right away at the beginning. And then once they started writing, they took off and they had their own sound and they did dabble in other things. They did put out a Sgt. Pepper's type of album, and they did, you know, they tried all those things, and yeah. So sonically, I just love them because they're a guitar driven rock band. Now, to answer the second part of your question, or the first part, actually, I should say, what separates them from other bands? I would say, you know, at the risk of sounding cliche, I would say it's the songs. The songs. That's kind of what separates most of the best artists from that era. You know, the artists that have longevity usually are the artists that have great songwriters, you know, whether it's a, whether it's the duo of Mick and Keith or Paul and John or Robert and Jimmy, as we talked about with Led Zeppelin, you know, and then there's the rest that might not have been able to live up to it. So I think the songs, I would probably reluctantly say that they're one of my top 10 favorite bands of all time. I mean, if you were to take a straw poll across the country, they would absolutely be probably one of the top five greatest bands of all time. I would probably put them in my top 10. I think that's, there might be a little bit of a longevity award to that. The fact that their very first show, I think, was on the deck of the Titanic, and they're still playing live shows now and putting out new albums now. It's ridiculously impressive. I mean, all kidding aside. Now, there's, of course, there's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be twists and turns. I, for one, don't like really anything they did in the 90s or the early 2000s. But that being said, here's what separates them in my mind. I have the utmost respect for the fact that they're not just going out there and playing their songs from the 60s and 70s for the past 50 years, playing the same set list. You know, we've talked about this before. My big issue with Guns N' Roses right now is that they're playing the same damn set list for 8 years in a row, and they haven't put out anything new. That drives me absolutely crazy. You can't have my money. I'm not going to go see you play live again. That kind of thing. Whereas the Stones, you know, even in their AARP years, they're putting out new albums. And dare I say, as you know, as I, you know, sum up this little answer to your question, I think that last album that they did a couple months ago, it was not bad. It was pretty good. It was,
it had a lot of good tracks.
It really did have a lot of good tracks. And apparently they've got another one written already in the can. I don't know.
But the thing about that too, and like, with the Stones, you have to have a really long timeline, because it's kind of crazy to think like over these 60 years and really their last record of new material was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, like 2000.
But that was still in the early 2000s. That was in the 21st century. And that was called, the album was A Bigger Bang. But guess what? That album was also pretty good. It had a lot of good tracks.
It was actually pretty. It was actually pretty decent. Yeah.
Yeah. There were like two or three songs that are in my like general rotation of Rolling Stone songs that I listen to all the time whenever I play them. So the fact that people are like, oh my God, it's like 60 years later and they've still got this really good album. I'm like, I don't think that's such an outlier when you consider their previous album was also like equally good. It's just the fact that there was a greater distance between the two.
Yeah, let me sum this up really quick. And this is, I think, kind of puts a bow tie on what I was trying to say. You know, like right now, we're seeing commercials left and right for the Rolling Stones tour that's about to come up. I keep seeing it on TV right now, you know. And no, under most normal circumstances, you couldn't pay me to go see a bunch of 80-year-old guys, you know, go on stage and play and mix, you know, Keith has arthritis and stuff. Like, there's a whole lot about that normally I would say, no way. There's not a chance. Yet, the difference is the Rolling Stones, unlike any other band of these heritage rock bands that are going out and touring and playing the greatest hits, with the Stones, you might see something you've never seen before right now. And I find that completely endearing. And, you know, Ryan opened this podcast talking about the Stones being Batman. Well, to quote Batman, a Batman reference, when Harvey Dent said, you either die a hero or you live long enough to become the villain. With most bands, the longer they stay and keep playing, they're going to be the villain eventually. They are going to not, they should have died young. And the Stones, with the last album that just came out, I think the Stones have completely bucked that trend. And I have the utmost respect for them. Don't get angry with me.
Tom, I haven't forgotten you. I want your answers to these questions, but I did just think about this. But something Neil said, listeners, if you get the chance, Marc Maron on one of his more recent, not his most recent, but one of his recent stand-up comedy specials, you can find it maybe on Netflix. He does it a whole bit, like 15 minutes, talking about the Rolling Stones and going to see them live and his trepidation about seeing them live because he thinks he thinks they're too old to play live and everything like that. And he doesn't want to see that. This band that meant so much to him, he doesn't want to see them so old and like falling down and everything. He thinks it'll be embarrassing. It'll be the lasting image that he has that ruins it. But then he actually kind of comes around and he says, no, once I was there, I was like, to see them still doing this at their age, that is really daring. He's like, that takes courage. He's like, in the 70s, if Keith Richards fell down and like knocked over a Marshall amp because he was high on coke or something, and they had to cancel the show in the middle of it, the audience would be like, it's Keith. Fuck yeah, man. And everybody would be laughing about it because they would just like go with it. He's like, but to see him actually doing it right now, it's like, that's bravery. Yeah, I've been a fan of Mark Maron since the Dr. Katz days back in the 90s. But anyway, Tom, your answers to the previous questions or just responses to anything that we've said.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of things to add to what you guys said, because I'm pretty much in agreement with all of you. They're a foundational band, too. I'm trying to think back prior to the Stones and as well as the Beatles to a band that was, capital letters, the biggest band in the world. And I think they set the standard for that and never really walked away from it. I know they got their start in smaller venues, but I honestly can't picture Mick Jagger anywhere but on a stage in an arena or a large venue. It just doesn't seem to fit. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's because of when I, you know, being younger than, you know, than my parents. By the way, I'm always jealous of the fact that, you know, you got so much from your dad. I mean, I could tell you all about Air Supply or Streisand or Sinatra, but, you know, that's my passion. Yeah, I had both. But no, I like, so just think about that. The fact that, like, because I listen, you know, you listen to a lot of other bands from that, from the 60s and 70s all the way forward, and you listen to Zeppelin, but like Aerosmith, mm-hmm. Guns N' Roses and even other bands that weren't as huge. And I hear the Stones, like when I'm listening to the stuff I was listening to this episode, I was hearing how other bands were aping this or playing it or whatever. And, you know, that's a testament to their ability. 'Cause the music is just damn good. You know, when I was writing notes for some of the songs, I was just like, this is just a damn good song. I don't have anything insightful to say about it. The other thing is, too, who else aside from, like, Dylan, Paul McCartney, maybe Clapton, is still making music on the level of, like, I'm putting something out on the regular 60-something years after they debuted? But you're right. A lot of those acts have just basically gone greatest hits, jukebox type of thing. I mean, even Cher stopped making music.
Yeah,
and she's been on a farewell tour for a decade and a half.
Right.
Like
right.
Maybe Paul Simon, but other than that,
Paul Simon, Paul Simon.
You name the ones that are still putting out stuff that is either vital or like attempts to be vital and has good stuff.
Tom, if you think about it, it's like even like Rod Stewart kind of graduated. He achieved a lot of success doing the Great American Songbook, kind of thing. But that's not original stuff anymore. So you're right.
Yeah, and Springsteen's 10 years later, you know, Asbury Park was 73, so he's got a little ways to go to beat this particular record. But yeah, it's just it's amazing that they've been there this long, even through ups and downs and things. And it's funny because when I think of the Beatles and Omar, I'm glad that you want to put to rest this whole binary, because I'm kind of the same way. Because Ryan's going through this, I'm like, well, why not both?
Yeah, exactly.
But I will tell you.
Neil will vouch for this. We grew up in a different atmosphere. It was one or the other. It was very Coke or Pepsi. Brand loyalty was a big thing for our household.
Totally.
Yeah, competition was everything. As a matter of fact, real quick, I don't mean to cut you off, Tom, but Ryan, I don't know if you're aware of this. When I was talking to our mom and dad about this podcast like a week or two ago, and mentioned that I was going to do this and asking if they had thoughts about it or anything. And my dad said when he was young and the Stones were in that, you know, that kind of in the Hot Rocks era, mm-hmm. he said, I'm not going to say one's better than the other, but he said, the guys like the Stones, the girls like the Beatles. And I thought that was very interesting. I'm like, okay, you just answered my question.
Interesting.
Yeah. So like, I like a lot of Beatles tunes, but I when I start running through some of my favorites, some of them are the grungier ones, you know, the ones that do go into the blues and things like that, as opposed to Yellow Submarine and that sort of thing. Nothing against that song, but you know, like the playful sort of polished stuff. But it's
talking about their longevity and like their sustained success, and Omar, you can, maybe this is sort of ties along with their branding, but this idea that I don't know if it's in spite of this fact or because of this fact, but throughout that 60 years, they've been remarkably comparatively free of tragedy and controversy associated with them.
Yeah, like, I mean, look, you have the Brian Jones thing.
Right, right. He, like, the founding member who left after a certain year. I mean, there was deaths, like, close to them. Like, he died in the Anita Pallenberg thing, but...
And then you have, like, Mick Taylor and, like, later Bill Wyman leaving. But, like, I'm fairly certain those were just, like, logistical. I'm kind of tired, especially in Bill Wyman's case. I'm just kind of tired of doing this after 30 years.
Right.
And you had like a
Jed and they were at least on good enough terms to come back and play with them for reunion shows or anniversaries.
Yeah, like I think I don't think there was any huge drama there, and I think you had a little bit of, you know, one-upsmanship between Jagger and Richards, especially in the 80s before they came back together and realized, you know, they were better together. And yes, I don't mean to hand wave all this away. You had, definitely had issues with drug addiction, particularly in the 1970s, particularly in the early and mid 70s. But like when you compare them, I mean, we have also done podcasts about bands like, as you mentioned, Van Halen and Guns N' Roses, where controversy just seemed to follow them and discord just seemed to follow them every step of the way. And, you know, I always try, especially as I get older, to grade everything that happens in life on a curve. And so like when I think about the sort of ups and downs within, you know, the dynamic, the group dynamic of the Rolling Stones, when I'm grading on that curve and I'm comparing them to, you know, the Beatles experience and Inner Turmoil. And I understand the Beatles experience was like asymmetrical and they were like a once in a lifetime phenomenon, but like the attention that came upon them, but also like bands like Guns N' Roses and Van Halen and so forth, they have been remarkably free of the kind of discord and drama that you would normally associate with, you know, huge pop culture phenomenons of 60 plus years. I don't know whether you were going to get into this in another separate section, but I think you were talking about, like, you know, you would raise the topic of like longevity in general and why they keep going on and what we think about them.
We can
come to that towards the end, but it's just like, and I have more thoughts on that, but like for the moment, I would just say it says a lot about them that the core members have stuck around and they think of this as their trade, and they'll get through any kind of like, you know, superficial difficulties that come along the way. But like when you talk about egos and jealousies and drugs and attention and the kind of things that tear a lot of greater, you know, a lot of lesser bands apart, and bands on the same level like the Beatles, I think they deserve credit. They deserve credit because their egos were not necessarily smaller than their contemporaries, but they managed to make it work for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, and just thinking like about the specific band members, you kind of mentioned the core of the band kind of like remaining intact. Like when you've got a rock band over so many decades, you mean there's obviously going to be some turnover, and that's just expected. I mean, the fact that like over 35 years or something, Pearl Jam's core unit has remained together, except they just cycled through drummers. And I don't want to like discount how great Charlie Watts was as the drummer of the Rolling Stones until his death just a couple of years ago. He was sensational. But you do think of the creative nexus of the Rolling Stones is Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. And the fact that they're both still alive despite their habits and everything like
that.
How often, like, it's weird for any creative partnership, let alone one under like the rigors of what they go through, to last. The fact that they're both still alive and everything. And that's actually gonna segue into, because I kind of want to talk about the band members themselves. Obviously, the front man, the face of the band, Mick Jagger. And Omar, as you were talking about branding, I think a large part of that is what Mick brought to the group in his, call it showmanship, his stage persona, this larger life, the way he dances, the costume changes, the physical appearance, the I guess it's sexuality. It's it is that. There's like just something about that that it comes with. And then Keith Richards on guitars and like his songwriting and his creativity and just like this sort of ashen, hollowed look about him, even when he was a teenager, you think, oh, this guy has been through 40 miles of bad road already. And he's still at like age 150. He still looks like that. But and then we had the aforementioned late Brian Jones, who was the other founding member guitarist, kind of played, he was a multi-instrumentalist. He kind of played everything, including vocals for a little bit until it was clear that Mick was superior. But he was really kind of, Brian Jones was responsible for bringing the group together, naming them. But because of issues, drugs and everything, they kicked him out in 1969 and he died a month later. We mentioned Bill Wyman was one of them. He was the founding members. He was a bassist from 1962, left the band in 1993. Charlie Watts was the drummer from the beginning until he just passed away in 2021. The first replacement of Brian Jones was Mick Taylor, who played guitar from 1969 to 1975, was really probably their greatest creative peak, I think, in terms of what their output was. And then Mick Taylor was replaced by Ronnie Wood from the Rod Stewart's group, The Faces, who continues to play with them now. The one other member that I wanted to mention was Ian Stewart, who was the founding member of the group, who was a piano player, credited as in 1962. He stayed with the band after that, but was no longer considered a permanent member of the group. But he continued to play with them until his death in 1985. So I just want to kind of, well, we don't have to mention all of those guys or talk about them, but just your thoughts on any one individual. But this was something that came to me when Neil was talking. I had to mention this one. Before I even got into their music, knowing about the Rolling Stones from afar, one of my earliest impressions, you mentioned talking about some of the music videos that were on MTV, and I do remember watching those. But I remember Eddie Murphy's line from Delirious.
Because all you have to do is sing. It's something about singing. That's the business. You sing, women go crazy. Because Mick Jagger is an ugly motherfucker. with big-ass lips. Mick Jagger's lips so big, black people be going, you got some big-ass lips.
And that line about Mick Jagger, like, has always stuck with me, and I always kind of remember that and think about it.
That's funny that you mentioned that, because I've heard Mick Jagger's stage persona described before as a peacock, and I thought that was very, very interesting and kind of accurate. Yeah. Like, he struts and walks and prunes like a peacock struts.
There is a bird like quality to it.
There's something very, very interesting about that.
So the opening band does their thing. Then they bring them out, the Rolling Stones, and they all come out. And I'm like, And so then there's Keith. Keith's doing a good job of being Keith at 72. His hair is natural color. He's not dangling shit from it anymore. He's looking good. He's doing a few of these. Couple of these. But not pushing it. Doing a good job. From what I could see of Charlie, he's looking good. He's solid. Gray hair. Solid on the drums. Looking good. Ronnie's a problem. His hair's dyed. He's running around. It's a little embarrassing. But he's the kid. He's 68. So I'm going to give Ronnie a pass. Now, if you're a real Stones fan, I believe that some part of you just tolerates Mick Jagger. All right? You know he's important. He's the Rolling Stones. But, yeah, it's Mick Jagger. So,
I mean, when I think of the Stones, I would probably say I think of the current lineup of the band minus the absence of Charlie Watt. Let's say their 80s, 90s era. Since Ron Wood joined the band, I think right. That's how I'll kind of always visually recognize the band in my head.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, from that concert that I said, the first concert I saw Let's Spend the Night Together on, that was it. And here's the weird thing. Surprisingly, like, some of my favorite songs were written by Brian Jones. Brian Jones wrote Ruby Tuesday, 19th Nervous Breakdown, Mother's Little Helper, Under My Thumb, The Last Time. Like, those were co-written by Brian Jones. Yet Keith Richards will always be my favorite Stone. He will always be. And obviously there's the guitar player in me. Obviously there's what I described earlier. The first time I saw them, he had that cool factor with the cigarette dangling and looked like he would just play when he wanted to. Like, there was something about that. And then as an adult later, as a guitar player, I learned that, well, he could do that because he always had an open G tuning, which means he barely had to have his hand on the fretboard. It was always in a chord. So those kind of things I learned, which then explained how he was just like kind of so nonchalant as a guitar player with just this cool ass attitude. Like, I don't care. You know, there was just something about that. You mentioned Mick Taylor, and I think this is, I don't know enough about that era to describe why, but Mick Taylor's really not credited with writing much, if anything. Maybe one or two songs during that era. Yet, like you said, some of their greatest album put out was during that time. Mm-hmm. So the only thing I can kind of attribute it to is I think that after Brian Jones left and then died, I think that that was when Mick and Keith really, really took it to another level. And yeah, that would be, I mean, Keith's the man, and he's going to be here. He was here before we were born. He'll be here after we die, you know, and that's him.
Yeah, and you mentioned, and I don't know if it's like part of that seemingly lethargic quality, but like, even though he's involved in the songwriting, what kind of fascinates me is like a lot of times they'll alternate between lead and rhythm guitar.
Yeah.
And I think it goes back to the Mick Taylor era, but certainly during the Ronnie Wood one, like he's not always the lead guitarist. He'll switch.
That's what's really interesting, because I've played in a handful of bands when I was young in my through high school. And then when I first moved to LA, I was in a couple of bands when nobody was really very good. But the one thing I remember about that time, when you're playing with a bunch of people that just kind of want to be in a band and they're not really good musicians, you memorize your part and then that's all you know of the song. So God forbid something happens to the other guitar player, you guys are screwed. That's kind of what I remember about being in bands. Whereas true, classically trained, good musicians can improvise and pick up any part. Like I agree with you, Ryan. I've seen, you know, in older days, as Keith Richards' arthritis has acted up, I've seen Ron Wood play a lot of Keith Richards parts in songs now. And I just find that interesting that, and the, you know, of course, Tom, you as a piano player, I'm sure you get this, you know, as I've gotten older and become more accomplished as a player, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, like you kind of, once you know the song, and you're a good musician, you can play any part in any, like, you know, if somebody calls in sick that night, all right, the band show must go on kind of thing. But in my younger days, I didn't recognize that as a thing. I was like, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that because, yeah, these, like, it's interesting seeing how much jazz improvisation is in a Keith Richards lick.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I never actually thought of that. I think I tend to focus on Mick Jagger more than I tend to focus on Keith Richards, even though I really do like Keith Richards. You were talking about how the band survived partially because they haven't had a lot of inner turmoil, et cetera, aside from what you mentioned.
Well, not inner turmoil that bubbled as much into the to the surface that we know of. I mean, certainly there are stories, but, you know, nothing on the level of what we've covered with previous bands.
It is kind of amazing that they did survive the 70s, though. I mean, literally survive the 70s, considering all the drugs and considering Altamont did not leave them with the best reputation. Gimme Shelter is a really interesting film. If you've ever seen that particular documentary.
Interesting, horrifying, who can say?
Yeah. It's just like, and Jagger looks like shell shocked through the entire, you know, when they're looking at the footage and everything. I think of him, and we go to him, and you talking about him, all the stuff you were talking about, the peacock struck and everything. That's a perfect description. He essentially defines what a front man is. You know, I mean, with you think about people who were front men of bands prior to Mick Jagger, I know he's taking from people like Little Richard and Chuck and Keith Richards is clearly taking from Chuck Berry because I know that like Chuck Berry was one of his, but you know, like maybe Elvis, but even Elvis was a solo act, right? And even Little Richard was a solo act in these things, you know. The Beatles have Lennon and McCartney, but like they don't have Mick Jagger. And like you think you look at the front men and front women of bands that came after the Stones. And I think he's the archetype. You know, you don't have Steven Tyler if you don't have Mick Jagger, obviously. You don't have you don't have a lot of these guys who just want to be like Mick Jagger is a rock star. And I think he defined that. And I think that's one of the things that makes him freaking cool.
I don't think you have Axl Rose without Mick
Jagger. I don't think
that's true. That's true.
David Lee Roth. Yeah, you said that.
Yeah. So
I would also like to, I think these are all very good points and I can't disagree with any of them. I have to put in a little bit of a tribute to my guy, Charlie Watts, who is my favorite member of the band.
Thank you. I wanted to mention,
His foundational training as a jazz drummer cannot be understated in terms of like how important it was to like the songwriting and like the structure of the songwriting. I also think just from a persona standpoint, there was something always very comforting about Charlie Watts. There was something that always made me as an audience member feel like no matter what is happening in terms of like Mick and Keith's sort of creative like wanderlust, like they will always be grounded as a blues-based band because Charlie would not let them stray too far from that original goal. I also, you know, I can't help but note the irony of the fact that like the grand old man, the teetotaler of the band, I mean, I don't know whether he abstained. I don't know whether he abstained from alcohol entirely, but certainly, again, as I get older, I grade everything on a curve and graded on a curve. His debauchery was non-existent compared to Jagger and Richards. This was someone who, you know, got married very early in life, always had that family structure around him to sort of ground him, was always on the straight and narrow, and you could always sort of sense him as the moral compass of that group. And I think, you know, if you talk to drummers, rock drummers for the preceding quarter century, half century, they will almost without exception point to Charlie Watts as a major, major influence. And this is very petty of me, because I love them all, but like I just cannot help but note the irony that, like, you know, much in the same way that like the two most serious earnest Beatles are the ones who are dead. it's like, you know, it's like the guy who like did everything the right way. Of course he dies before Mick and Keith, of course, because that's how life goes. But I really miss him. I really, really, really miss him. I was unexpectedly emotional when I found out he died. You guys correctly point out how solid and out this latest record is, Hackney Diamonds. And you know, it's worth noting that he had a couple of contributions to some tracks on that. But I think one of his finest hours of the last like 25 years was his presence and his work on the you brought up the A Bigger Bang record from 2005 and Hackney Diamonds from last year, but in between in 2016, an otherwise regrettable year for the world culturally and politically and everything else, the Stones released a gem of a covers album, Blue and Lonesome, and it was tremendous. And you can see Charlie Watts's influence all over that album, just like standard Chicago-based like blues songs that they cover and they just play the shit out of. So I cannot go without, you know, paying tribute to Charlie Watts, my favorite member, but I think someone who plays a pivotal role as the musical and moral rock and compass of the group.
I think I'm glad you brought that up because I did want to mention him. I think the discipline and the structure that he brought, you called him the moral compass. I might call him the adult in the room.
Sure. That's a really good way to put it. Yeah.
And sure. Like, even like when you look at them, like in their later years, when Mick and Keith are still dressing, like in the sort of even pre-glam kind of like.
Nah, Charlie's a gentleman. Charlie dresses like a gentleman.
He's wearing a suit and tie and he's been on the terms and it's like, or a sweater. And it's like, you know. I kind of mentioned that the period when Mick Taylor kind of filled in like the last few years of Brian Jones's life. And then when Mick Taylor kind of came, the late 60s and early 70s, there is this amazing peak and string of albums. I don't know if you can find anything better, like any catalog, but I just kind of wanted to ask you guys, like, what you think is their best, the best era of the Rolling Stones, or the best particular album. And I have a follow-up question specifically about this, but is that the era that I'm citing, is that like the best of the Rolling Stones, or do you think it's actually their earlier 60s stuff or more recent?
That's certainly my favorite era. I think I wrote down from about 66 or so Aftermath, I believe, all the way up until maybe Exile on Main Street is kind of where I primarily sit when I go back and listen to them. I listen to the stuff from the late 70s and early 80s. Everything after Tattoo U, most of the stuff from the 80s after Tattoo U, and I don't really think I've listened to, except for Steel Wheels. And then I think everybody I knew had Voodoo Lounge in the 90s. And then so I kind of flit in and out between Tattoo U and now. But I mean, but yeah, everything from all of the hits that I know from there and all the albums I know. I think my favorite album is probably Let It Bleed. Although that's like, but, you know, choosing between that and Beggar's Banquet and, you know, Exile Main Street, I could rotate those among my favorite Stones albums. But yeah, I think you're right in there. And I think it is, I don't know if it's the counterculture and the drugs. I think it's just both the fundamental blues rock stuff mixed with this want to go in different directions, but never going so far that they put out some like really shitty concept album that everybody wants to forget, you know?
That kind of dovetails into my follow-up question that I'll put this out there now. I think almost any serious critic or list would claim that Exile on Main Street is their best album. And I want to ask you guys if you agree with that. Do you think Exile is their best album?
Your mileage may vary, and I completely understand. I would say that Exile on Main Street is not only their best album, but if someone said it was the best pop rock album of like, you know, the last like 60, 65, 70 years, you know, you could quibble, but I really wouldn't have a problem with that claim. So that's my answer to your most recent question, your second question. My answer to your first question is total agreement that it's, and I don't think, listen, music and art are subjective, and I'm sure you guys would absolutely vociferously agree with that. I would say that there are some instances where there are sort of objective observations that can be made. And I think an objective observation is that that era, and I'm specifically delineating it at the Beggar's Banquet right up through Exile on Main Street. So Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, and then the live album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, and then Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street. That is like one of the great all-time Pantheon runs. In fact, it might be the best. Yep. And I think, you know, Ryan, it's funny you brought up Eddie Murphy's Delirious in reference to them. And I think Eddie Murphy is like a pretty good analogy in the sense that like you can have bands or artists or actors or filmmakers that have exalted long careers that, you know, have mostly peaks or no valleys but you know, I think we would all agree on this episode that like the Stones definitely have their peaks and valleys. There are definitely creative down points to the band's era. That's part of the deal when you're at 60, you know, 50 plus years, almost 60 years of recorded output. But if you were to bottle up that run, and I think of Eddie Murphy all the time, which is why no matter what kind of crap Eddie Murphy might put out in the last few years, I would say that like, I don't care what he does, because that Saturday Night Live Trading Places era, right up early 80s, 1980, 81, right up through like Coming to America, that 7-year run would, if you want to say Eddie Murphy, right up there with like, you know, Robert De Niro or whatever, I would be like, hey, based on that run alone, absolutely. And so it is with the Stones. Like that is one of the great unprecedented creative rushes that like you could just bottle up that era of that's the era of songwriting genius. And I think it has to do with like the age they were, like the sociology of it all, the time frame they were dealing with, what they were writing about, having the Beatles as like, you know, like their main songwriting rivals, as well as like something like Pet Sounds having come out to redefine the era. There was this weird alchemy that they were playing with. And it was like, it was once in a lifetime, that run. And so Ryan, you know, I guess I accept that you said that people might quibble as to what eras of the Rolling Stones might be, you know, equal or better than that. But like, I just think that even though in art, there's very few objective facts, I think it's pretty silly to think that there's any other era that could equal that. I think that is a staggering, towering run, that 4 or 5 year output.
You know, keep in mind too, that Exile on Main Street is one of the very rare double albums that isn't bloated you know, you pull up a lot of double albums and you could cut 4 or 5 songs off of it and just make it a very long single
album. That's the common refrain, right? That's the common refrain of double albums.
Yeah.
They even say that. Some people even say that about like the Beatles' White Album, which feels sacrilegious at times, but people say that. They never say that about Exile on Main Street.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to belabor the point, but, you know, my discovery of the Stones was that Hot Rocks era, 64 to 71. I would probably say that all the albums that coincided with that greatest hits collection would be my sweet spot. I do have to, you know, carry it forward a little bit farther, though, up to, because, like I said, you know, I had that distinct memory of the concert video, Let's Spend the Night Together, and an aerial camera shot, like a helicopter camera shot of the stadium as they started Start Me Up. And you just heard the guitar chords, da-na-na, and the crowd just went nuts. And in a live setting, even though it was 1981. So I guess I probably have a little bit more of an affinity for Tattoo You than I want to or care to admit. But that there's, I don't know, just something about that. So we're splitting hairs at this point, you know, but my sweet spot would be, yeah, the 60s, early 70s.
I do want to give a shout out to one of their more maligned albums is 1976's Black and Blue. I actually like a lot of songs from that album. It is not regarded very well. I think one publication called it the laziest album they ever wrote. But that's got like 3 out of, there's like 8 songs on it. 3 of them are among my favorites. But one of the reasons, and I co-sign what you guys are saying, but I did want to come back to Exile on Main Street because I've had this thought like in my mind for a couple of years now. I think it is, unobjectively among the greatest rock or blues rock albums ever created. I don't think it's the best Rolling Stones album. And the distinction I make, and this will be my source for this. Out of curiosity, I have an Amazon Music subscription, and I went on Amazon and just entered in Rolling Stones. And they'll give you their list of top songs. And I don't know what algorithm they use, but it's based on popularity and plays and things like that. And it's got, and this was right when Hackney Diamonds came out. So they had like, Angry and the Lady Gaga song that they do on that were both high on the list and everything. So if you cut those out, I'll ask you guys, where do you think in number order, where do you think the first song from Exile on Main Street came in the list? What song do you think it was?
I would say between 5 and 10, and was it Tumbling Dice?
Nope. Again, I don't know what Amazon's I don't know what their algorithm is or how they determine these songs of popularity, but first song
on everyone, so they probably have a pretty good idea.
Well, the first song from Exile was Happy. It was Happy.
No, okay. I thought it was Rocks Off.
No, that's the first song on the album. I mean, the first song that they had on Amazon's list.
I'm going to say that somewhere in the teens.
Song first.
it was the song Happy, and it was song 17 on their list.
That's nonsense.
Now, if you scratch off the 2 songs from Hackney Diamonds, that means the most popular song from supposedly their best album was their 15th most popular track, according to the algorithm. So if you made, forget about Hot Rocks, but if you made like a greatest hits album that if you cut it to 14 tracks, nothing from Exile makes it. So
wow.
I think it's, there's a cohesion and there's a unity and there's a beauty to that album that works on its own.
And there's a
If I was going to give an uninitiated person a Rolling Stones album and says, this is what you need to hear to get a sense of who the band is, I would give them either Sticky Fingers or Let It Bleed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that's that controversial. I mean, I think many of us are in agreement that Exile is the best album, but like, you know, a simple cursory Google search of rank, you know, just asking, you know, trying to find rankings list of the top Rolling Stones albums, it's not necessarily the universal consensus that Exile is the best one. I think it's pretty common to find Exile to be number one or in the top 3 at least. But like, I find many people, you know, championing Sticky Fingers, and quite a few people championing Let It Bleed or Beggar's Banquet, I don't think that's that controversial. I would say, to the Amazon point, it's possible that for me personally, and for a lot of people I know that like Exile the best, the beauty is in the consistency of the songwriting. I mean, mm-hmm. they might not, it's not shocking to me. Like, I don't necessarily think there's a song on Exile that is better than the best songs on Let It Bleed, for instance, right? I think the best songs on Let It Bleed, like I'm thinking about, like, you know, Gimme Shelter or Midnight Rambler, You Can't Always Get What You Want. Those are the ones that have like morphed into like pop culture. You hear that, you see them on, hear them on TV shows, you hear them on film soundtracks, like we say. But I think there's a quality to Exile, not only a thematic consistency, but like, whereas with Let It Bleed and Beggar's Banquet, some of the tracks there, like Sympathy for the Devil or whatever, they'll have some home runs. I feel like with Exile, you're consistently hitting like doubles and triples. Does that make sense in terms of the track listing?
Yeah, but as I kind of circle back to the point earlier, when we think of this band as this stadium arena rock band that is kind of this larger than life, I think you kind of have to put their greatest hits and their top singles at the forefront. And that's why I would say a more quintessential Rolling Stones album would be Let It Bleed or Sticky Fingers, even though if we're judging like a music critic or the quality of the songwriting of the album as a whole, Exile might be better. But that was just, again, maybe this is a more like, you know, a thinner distinction than I was kind of giving credit for. But I found that interesting.
No, I kind of get
it. It is interesting. I don't find it an outlandish point at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I would like, it's as we go forward and talk about some of our favorite songs, like I already described my sweet spot for like the era of the Stones I like the most were those albums between 64 and 71. Yet some of my individual favorite songs were not on those albums.
Right, right. Yeah, and I can coast on that, and we'll actually address that when we get to some of our hits. But
yeah.
To your point about Exile, Ryan, how far down the list do you have to go to hit in a Beatles list to hit something from Sgt. Pepper?
Oh, that's a very good point.
I mean, because I can't get that pulled up on Amazon, but I'm on Spotify. None of those songs.
Oh, that's a really good point. And Revolver, which is often cited as their best album alongside Sgt. Pepper. I think you bring up a really awesome point.
Yeah. Angel, you're beautiful.
Goodbye, Andy. I still love you. Remember all those nights we cried.
So I just looked up, I'm on the Amazon Music app, and I looked up the Beatles, and their top song is "Antihero" by Taylor Swift.
Nice.
Wow. There you go.
I did something wrong.
That was a good John Lennon song. Hey, you know, real quick before we move on, I just remembered this, and it's actually quite funny. And I was in Los Angeles like 97, 98, right around. I think their national tour was Bridges of Babylon or Bridges of Babylon tour. And I remember a couple of my friends were going to see them at the time and asked me if I wanted to go. And tickets were super expensive and we would have had bad seats. So I wasn't really into it. But the argument that took place between me and a couple of friends that were going was, I was saying, no, they're too old. I don't want to see them. They're too old. They probably can't play live. And this is 1997. And then their argument was, yeah, but this will probably be the last time they play live.
Yeah.
So that was the argument. Like, should I check this off the list? Because they could all be dead tomorrow. And that was, what, 30 years ago? And they're going on tour again.
Now we get to the fun part where we talk about some of our favorite songs specifically. In advance of this recording, listeners, I posted on the Fire and Water Discord and Facebook page asking people for their favorite Stones songs. A lot of people told me to screw off. They hated the Rolling Stones and they were overrated. I hope you guys aren't listening. What the hell? But just a really quick rundown of some of the responses that included Backstreet Girl, Beast of Burden, Bitch. I'm doing these in alphabetical order, by the way. Brown Sugar, Can't You Hear Me Knocking, Dead Flowers, Gimme Shelter, Happy, I Am Waiting, Jumping Jack Flash, The Last Time, Love Is Strong, Miss You, The Disco Version, Monkey Man, Mother's Little Helper, No Expectations, Paint It Black, Play With Fire, Ruby Tuesday, Satisfaction, She's a Rainbow, She's So Cold, Start Me Up, Sway, Sympathy for the Devil, Wild Horses, Who's Been Sleeping Here, and You Can't Always Get What You Want. So instead of the usual format where we each mention a song and kind of rotate one at a time round robin style, in the interest of time and sanity, we're going to give our entire list of five, explaining why we picked these songs, and then give each other a chance for others to respond. So I will start. As I so often do, I want to preface that these five songs are not my definitive top five favorites, but they are songs that each had an effect on me as I was listening, or that I had felt merited some kind of discussion, and I didn't want them overlooked. So, first song, Gimme Shelter. I think you can make a case that this is their greatest song. Objectively, I think it's definitely in the top three. It is one of the all-time greatest lead-off tracks for an album. It's track one on Let It Bleed. It's not anywhere close to Mick Jagger's best vocal performance. In fact, he's completely overshadowed by the guest vocalist on the song, who is Mary Clayton. I think when you think of Gimme Shelter and you think of the vocals, you think of her voice, which is kind of ironic. Yeah, Mary Clayton, she was a gospel and soul singer, and I think that speaks to the band's influences and the DNA of their music, the soul that they channel in their music and the writing and the craft. And I think that speaks, I think the best cover versions that I have heard of this song are sung by women. But this song, it evokes tension and violence, jealousy, suspicion, war, chaos, murder, rape, obviously. It's both tribal and apocalyptic. According to the notes, Keith played both guitar parts on the recording, lead and rhythm. This was after Brian's exit and before they hired Mick Taylor. The solo in the song might be my favorite Keith Richards solo in any of their songs. But to me, there has just always been something striking about the harmonica sound in this. It feels like it's out of tune somehow, but there's just something. It's overwhelming in a good way, not just a good way, a great way. So I think this is their best song. Moving on. Track two on my list, Mixed Emotions. This one is from the 1989 album Steel Wheels, and it's probably the first Rolling Stones song I heard or that I remember. It was the first big hit in my lifetime, or in my young life as a listener of music, as a connoisseur. As a kid, I thought they were singing "You're Not the Only One with Misty Motions," I thought was the line. And I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded kind of grown up and vaguely sexual, which you could apply that to other songs of theirs. I always liked the song. I always thought it was a great hook. As a kid, before diving into the band, I remember hearing Start Me Up and Satisfaction a lot. And those songs just never really did much for me. But I loved Mixed Emotions as a more traditional rocker. I love the tempo, the energy. It was a bit more pop rock, and that helped me sort of slide into them more casually. I knew that your lists were going to concentrate on the band's kind of prime in the 60s and the 70s, so I wanted to give some love to later period Stones, which leads me to track three, which is Streets of Love.
Just one more chance.
This is from the aforementioned 2005 album, A Bigger Bang. And I wanted to mention that their later area, their 21st century songs, these are not outliers, and these are not just like a band that is just too old. There is still really good material on these albums. Biggest Mistake is great. There's also another Keith Richards sung song called The Room Is Empty, which is really, really good. And then there's this one, Streets of Love. And I love the Stones' ballads almost as much as I love their rock songs. As Streets of Love is a great ballad. It's not a power ballad, but a ballad with a lot of volume and energy and soul. That's what I like about it. This feels like a return to their R&B roots. Track 4 is Rocks Off. This is the first track on Exile on Main Street, and this is actually kind of a recent discovery, sort of. I believe I listened to Exile in its entirety 20 years ago after listening to Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville, because I wanted to compare the two song by song. But I came back to it just a few years ago with an ear for really scrutinizing the album and some of the songs that I had overlooked. And this one, right out of the gate, just blew me away. It's a bit of a mess. It's not recorded or mixed very well. Mixed vocals are too low, I think. The band has complained that the studio was too hot and they couldn't keep the guitars in tune. There's a weird part in the middle when the song goes a little bit psychedelic and stretched out. They have like one of the very earliest like vocal modulation effects or something that they had at the time. But the song captures this tense energy of the band feeling strung out and wound too tight at the same time. The last couple of minutes of the song, the backup instruments steal the show. There's piano played by Nicky Hopkins and brass by Bobby Keys and Jim Price. And they just work it. And the sound of the piano and the horns, it puts an odd honky-tonk or Southwest image in my head. Like, when I listen to this song, it creates a movie in my mind. I can see a car racing or like a montage at the beginning of a film of cars racing in the desert. And it's intercut with somebody like a young man or young woman rebuilding a car's engine in the little garage in the desert and then racing it. Like it's like a Fast and Furious intro or something like that with plumes of sand and smoke kicked up with the last 2 minutes of the song. And I want to see that visualized or something like that. So this has become possibly my favorite Rolling Stone song over the last couple of years. And then we get to my fifth and final track, which is Wild Horses.
No.
Sticky Fingers. Tom, when we talked about cover songs, I think I mentioned the Sundays version of this song that came out in 1992.
Yes.
And that was probably the first time I heard the song. It was on a mixtape that Neil had sent me. And I strongly considered it for our covers episode, but as beautiful as that rendition is, I don't like it more than the original. I think this is the Rolling Stones' best ballad. Angie is number two, and I might talk about that one later. I think Angie has a better vocal performance from Mick Jagger. But I think this is one of the greatest ballads of all time. This one of those songs that I used to sing to Reese to put him to bed at night. And I don't sing a lot for reasons, but when your audience can't talk back to you, that helps. I think everything about this song is just damn near perfect. It almost makes me cry listening to it. So those are my five. And again, like, these are not necessarily my five favorites, although I would say three of them are. Wild Horses, Rocks Off, and Gimme Shelter are probably my top five, but I wanted to mention the other songs because they have an emotional connection to me. But, you know, honestly, guys, I mean, we're going to talk about 20 songs between all of our lists. I made a song and a playlist in preparation for this episode that's 50 songs deep, because that's how many Rolling Stones I like. I could have talked about Shine a Light or Angie or Memory Motel or Biggest Mistake or Hand of Fate. Again, two of those songs coming from Black or Blue, which is one of the least favorite Stones albums, but I still dig it. So any thought, and again, you guys don't have to comment on all of these. I hope you don't comment on all of them, but Omar, any thoughts about my list or some of the songs I mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I love that you are standing for A Bigger Bang, which I think is a fantastic album that they did, a late career album that they did, especially after what I think is the creative wilderness of the 90s, where studio recordings clearly took a backseat to the live experience. And I would just say that, you know, I mean, I think we would have all have fought for Gimme Shelter. You know, there's just always going to be a lot of overlap in what our initial choices would have been for favorite songs. Gimme Shelter is the song that really introduced me to the Rolling Stones, and I think it is their signature song that captures the essence and spirit of the band at their highest aspiration. I think it's a great list, headlined by, I think, the definitive Rolling Stones track.
Yeah, to add to that, I'll say about two of the songs. I may have only ever listened to Streets of Love once or twice prior to listening to it again this morning, and I was blown away in a way that I didn't expect. And I could see this as a cover or a duet with somebody, a female voice, like Brandi Carlile came to mind. Somebody's got that sort of like, who can match Mick Jagger in their like sort of gravelly smokiness of a voice. And Wild Horses to me is just, it is my favorite of the Stones ballads. It is cigarettes and booze on a record, and it's just, and the woman in this song is just sexy as hell. I'm just like, it is such a great song.
I think we've all touched on the same things. Wild Horses is one of the nice thing about doing a list like this with four people on it is that, like, other people can name the songs that I would have had to choose, you know, that kind of thing. It works out really well for me this way, because Wild Horses is one of those songs that should be on almost everybody's list. It's almost like the perfect soundtrack song. Like, that's what I think of. It feels like you could plug that into any indie movie from the 90s. You know, that kind of thing. Gimme Shelter, I was trying to think of it, and I don't remember the year, but you guys were talking about, like, other people you've heard cover it. I want to say it had to be roughly 2004 to 2008, somewhere around there. There was a big worldwide global Earth Day celebration that took place. It was kind of like, they kind of copied, like, Live Aid, but they did it in multiple cities to cover all the different time zones.
Oh, it was 2005, yeah.
Okay, 2005. And I remember they had it was broadcast all day. And so there was, like, they were playing in New York, and then they were in LA, and then they were in London and all the stuff. Keith Urban ended his set. And at the time, he was kind of a nobody in the pop culture. He ended his set doing Gimme Shelter, and halfway through the song, or right before the chorus, brought out Alicia Keys to sing the chorus.
Oh, nice.
And that introduced then her set, but she actually sang the second verse entirely, not just the girl part. She did Mick Jagger's part for the second verse. And oh my God, she knocked it out of the park. It was amazing. So that's, I just kind of had that memory of how that song, that you guys talked about the sexiness of that song. Oh my God, did she take it somewhere? So
right around that time, the mid 2000s those aughts, Patti Smith put out an album of covers that included Gimme Shelter, and her version was really, really good. All right, Omar, your list of five.
Sure. And I, for the reason stated previously, I will be quick. There's a lot of these to get through. So my first pick was coming off a record that I have long debated with friends of mine, fellow Stones fans, friends of mine, regarding the shelf life of this record. and how well it stands up to the test of time. Because when I was initially getting into the band, I was very dismissive of On Her Satanic Majesty's Request, because, you know, I was sort of indoctrinated to believe that it was a very low rent, desperate, pathetic, sweaty, attempt to glom on to what the Beatles had achieved with Sgt. Pepper's. And it took some time. It took many, many years for me to sit with that album and really like revel in what's wonderful about it. And it's not perfect. There's still some patchiness to it, but I keep coming back to the track, She's a Rainbow. She comes in colors. I think it benefits from the ethos behind the songwriting of that album and the sort of like mysticism and like hippiness of it all, but also is grounded in a very asymmetrical, unusual sweetness for the Rolling Stones. I mean, one could make the argument it's their prettiest song. It is a love song. It is a song. It is a love song that does not have tongue planted firmly in cheek. I'm very happy that it received, it was brought back to life a little bit in pop culture a few years ago by a very prolific inclusion in Apple TV Plus's Ted Lasso show. It is wonderful. It is earnest, and earnestness is not a quality I always associate with the very best Rolling Stone songs. And I'm happy if it allows people to rediscover what I think is sometimes an unfairly overlooked record, even previously by me. My second choice is the closing track on Beggar's Banquet, called Salt of the Earth. I love this song for many of the opposite reasons, because there is a sense with me that it is written with a little bit tongue planted firmly in cheek. The lyrics are wonderful. They're class conscious, but they're also class conscious. And I don't know whether they're making fun of class consciousness a little bit. I think that, you know, like the songwriter like is projecting like a distance between his subject that I think is kind of neat. There are biblical quotes in there, and like mixed vocal work is tremendous. I think the use of the slide guitar throughout the song is pretty terrific. I'm fairly certain that this is one of the few songs off of Beggar's Banquet that was not, they did not use a personal tape recorder to record. It was recorded in a studio. I think it's a very like joyous song to end a very sprawling yet kind of bleak album on. I really love Salt of the Earth. My next two choices are off the same record. The first one is the title track off of Let It Bleed. Yeah, we all need someone. A very campy quality to this song, the vocal work by Mick Jagger is wonderful. Like the way he like draws out his words is kind of intoxicating. And there's like there a lot of sexual references, a lot of drug references, but like it's not with this hard edge. I feel like he emotionally leaves himself a little bit of wiggle room. That I really, really enjoy. It's there's a very lackadaisical, ramshackle way to the way the arrangement comes together, which I really enjoy. And it feels like thematically it continues what they're trying to achieve in the Let It Bleed record, sum total, but the sound is very casual. And I like that. The sound is very like, hey, come hang out with us. This is fun. We're having a good time. Whereas, you know, songs like, you know, off that same album, songs like, you know, Gimme Shelter and the final track, You Can't Always Get What You Want, are tinged with like such seriousness and earnestness, and terror, frankly, in the vocal, and in the guitar work, that this feels like a break, even though thematically it's pretty heavy. My next choice is the very next track on Let It Bleed. And to me, other than Gimme Shelter, it is the signature Rolling Stones sound, the signature Rolling Stones song. And, you know, when we get into this subsequent section in our discussion about why the Rolling Stones continue to keep going on and on, even at the risk of ridicule in the larger pop culture, I think of this song. I keep coming back to this song. This is a perfect distillation, Midnight Rambler, of like their blues-based ethos.
Did you hear about the Midnight Rambler?
I love this song. It is a perfect combination of the sound that they have always been trying to attain and advocate for and celebrate, but also comes underneath this apocalyptic umbrella theme of the Let It Bleed album. It's beautiful. When I think of the Rolling Stones, yes, I think of Midnight Shelter, but I also think of Let It Bleed, because I think that from a sonic standpoint, from a thematic standpoint, like this is what they spent their whole career aiming for. And I think of this song when I consider the question of why they've been doing this for like 60 plus years. My final song is one of the tracks, one of the opening tracks on their great big comeback album from the late 70s, from the Some Girls record, and it's Miss You.
I've been holding out so long, I've been sleeping all alone, Lord, I miss you.
Alluded earlier to the fact that, you know, there's this tendency by the group, by Jagger in particular, to try and chase the cultural trend of the moment. And sometimes that leads them into like sort of genius territory, like with the late 60s and early 70s, and with their porthole blues-based approach. Sometimes it leads them into like icky territory, like in the 80s, trying to ape the synth sound and be overproduced. And you would think that them kind of self-consciously swerving into the disco era would be similarly cringeworthy. No freaking way. Like, Miss You is like the most confident and self-assured songwriting that they've had in at least like 6 years since the Exile on Main Street effort, like record. It is like confident, it is sexy, it is like well written, it is well paced, it is of its time, but it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. And it's evidence of the fact that like you can sometimes teach old dogs new tricks. You know, the guy was at the ripe old age of 35, I guess, which I believe we're all older than. But at the time it was a shock to like our cultural system, and they fit right into like whatever was going on like in that cultural landscape. So I really love Miss You, and I think it's like their last. I mean, Neil has brought up Tattoo You as a very good record. And Ryan, I know you have affection for Steel Wheels and the 21st Century stuff, as I do too. But I think that in terms of like greatness, in terms of like sheer greatness, in terms of like sheer Pantheon level, Hall of Fame level songwriting, Miss You and Some Girls is sort of like their last gasp of like superiority.
It's the song that it reminds me of, a Marvin Gaye song in a lot of ways. You said it was sort of that time. I do kind of, I get that sense. It also kind of reminds me of a Flight of the Conchords song. I think they wrote one that might have been parroting or mimicking this one. I'm really glad that you included Salt of the Earth on your list, because that was one that I had largely forgotten. And I listened to Beggar's Banquet, the album, so long ago. And I like Sympathy for the Devil was the one that kind of stuck with me. And I kind of largely forgot about the other ones. But when I heard the song again, I was like, oh, I do remember really liking the song. Why didn't it stay with me? But I'm glad, like, once I gave it a re-listen recently as we were composing our list, I was like, yeah, this is great. I really dig this song for all the reasons you said. And the only other one that I'll mention is Midnight Rambler. Aside from the serious blues artists, many of which the Rolling Stones were inspired by and kind of like sprung out of, I would say in terms of like a popular mainstream rock song, Midnight Rambler is probably the best harmonica song ever. And I say no that doubt. even after praising the harmonica work in Gimme Shelter, I just think there's something when we talked about that sound of Midnight Rambler. Yeah, it's quite amazing. Tom, Neil, any other thoughts about this list?
I was going to say the exact same thing about the harmonica on Midnight Rambler. It's freaking awesome. Miss You toes the line of kitsch, especially the disco mix, but never steps over it. And I think that takes some serious skill.
Yep.
It's an earworm, by the way. The thing's going to be stuck in my head for the next 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
My pleasure.
She's a Rainbow was recently also in a commercial, and I can't place it right now, but there's a car going through a car wash, and the song comes on, and oh boy, can anybody help me out? Do you guys remember this? It was like a Microsoft commercial or something. She comes in colors everywhere, like the car.
Oh yeah. Like a printer commercial or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe something like that. Anyway, so that's kind of how it re-entered my pop culture vernacular. And Miss You, there's something about that that kind of feels, every time I hear that, I feel kind of like it's like the seedy, darker side of Studio 54 or something. Like that's kind of where I place that song. But that's it. Yeah. Other than that, yeah, I have nothing. Everybody said everything about the rest of those songs.
Omar, you talked about the sort of Let It Bleed and the lyrics and sort of evoking the sex and the drugs, but not necessarily the hard edge. There is a little bit something almost kind of warm and welcoming about it. And like the lyrics that always stuck with me from a very young age when I heard it was, there will always be space in my parking lot. Guys, I don't think she's talking about parking a car. And then the next line is, when you need a little Coke and sympathy. It's like, okay, we're not in metaphor now. We're very upfront.
That's what I like. It doesn't veer away from sort of the harsher edges of what they're talking about on the album, the rest of the songs on the album. But it does not leave me feeling apocalyptic like the rest of that record does.
And, you know, we all need someone we can cream on. It's like, guys, it's like what about the songs in my generation that were getting like booed by Congress and everything? It's like that. What were you guys listening to when you were kids? But
well, I've been to enough LA Hollywood parties where it's like the invitations will say, "You bring the Coke, we'll provide the sympathy."
All right. Speaking of that, Neil, let's hear your list. What are your five?
Okay, so I tried to do something really interesting. We spent a lot of time going over each other's lists, and each of us probably started out with about 20, and we all tried to narrow them down. And I was hoping for and praying for a little bit of overlap and you guys to kind of pick songs that I normally would have to choose, and it worked. It worked out for the best for me. So then I started to kind of try and do something fun. Earlier, I talked about in the podcast about how Keith Richards kind of invented this open G tuning to make playing the guitar much easier. And surprisingly, without intentionality, a lot of those songs make my list of favorite songs. So real quick, before I give you my top five, I just want to point out, because I think this is fun, I want to point out these are some of the Rolling Stones songs that Keith Richards wrote in the exact same open G tuning, which is basically he takes the E string off. So it's a five string guitar and it's tuned to a G chord. And so he doesn't really have to move his hand a whole lot. He can keep the same position up and down the neck to change chords. These are some of the songs that were written in that tuning. Angie, Brown Sugar, Honky Tonk Woman, Jumpin' Jack Flash, Paint It Black, Start Me Up, Sympathy for the Devil, Tumbling Dice, Wild Horses, Happy, The Last Time. that right there is a pretty damn good playlist.
That's a winning formula, whatever he did.
I'm telling you, and it was not intentional to do that, but right there, that could be a playlist in and of itself. I think that's awesome. So I thought initially I was going to take five songs off that list, and they were all going to be my five were going to be all songs that were just in the open G tuning. And I came close, but one song I had to choose that was standard tuning just because of how I remember it. So most of these songs are picked from the same era that I've talked about a lot, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail and waste a lot of our listeners' time describing them. I do remember these all kind of carry a little bit more. Ryan, you and I have talked a lot about our affinity for live versions of songs if we hear that first. Mm-hmm. A lot of these are taken straight from the Let's Spend the Night Together concert video. And I remember that, the energy that was played live with the crowd reaction. So going down the list, number five for me off of Let It Be, Let It Bleed was Honky Tonk Woman. Or what was it called? Oh, God, it had a different name on the album.
Country Honk?
Yep, that was it. I think that was it. Anyway, Honky Tonk Woman. Okay, the next song on my list would be the aforementioned Keith Richards written song that Amazon chooses to say is the best song off of Exile, Happy. This song I like just because it's pure fun. I love hearing Keith Richards try to sing, and then Mick Jagger kind of steals the microphone from him live and just kind of takes over the song, even though Keith is trying to sing it. This song I've also heard covered. The members of Green Day have a cover. Tom, you and I have talked about this with Ryan before. Mm-hmm. The band's called The Cover-Ups. And yeah, it's basically the guys of Green Day, including their roadies, their techs, and all of a sudden they go out and they play just random cover songs. But they're all kind of punk / alternative / 80s stuff, like a weird hodgepodge of songs. And Happy makes their list, and I think it's really fun. It's just a lot faster with the way they do it. Then I would go with arguably these two songs go battle back and forth for top spot for me a lot, and I go back and forth between Tumble and Dice. And Brown Sugar. Brown Sugar, I want your taste so good. Brown Sugar, just like a young girl should. On any given day, either one of those could be my favorite Stone song off that list. Again, from the same era, the Tumbling Dice came from Exile off of 72, like Happy did. Brown Sugar was off Sticky Fingers in 71. And then finally, the last song on my list that was not in the open G tuning, but again, I will always carry with me the moment of seeing it live in that concert video from 1981. I'm going with Beast of Burden off of Some Girls in 1978. There's just such a beautiful sonic tone to this song. I've tried to emulate this guitar tone with effects pedals because there's a lot of reverb, a little bit of phase, a little bit of an echo on it. It's borderline The Edge from U2 has sort of a same kind of sound effect to this guitar track, but I don't know how else to describe it, but I just absolutely love this song.
My lasting memory or enduring memory of Beast of Burden was a live performance, but not by the Stones. It was 1996 during a VH1 honors ceremony. There was a live duet of the song sung by Joan Osborne and Tony Rich. The reason I remember it is because prior to that, I knew Joan Osborne from the song, you know, What If God Was One of Us. That was her big hit, which I thought was okay, but I don't really care for the song that much. But when I saw her doing this duet with Tony Rich, and she wasn't wearing anything like risque, she was just wearing like a red dress and like black leggings or something. But there was a sexuality about the performance, and I was like, she looks good. Like, I don't know what it is, but like the song just made, like, covering the song made Joan Osborne sexy to me at that age. And I was like, all right, I'm digging this song. So for some reason, that's kind of my lasting memory with this one.
Did you badasses ever hear the Bette Midler cover of Beast of Burden?
I do remember it.
I
only remember it now because you said it.
Oh, it's quite something, Neil.
Nice save, goalie.
You might want to get in the Wayback Machine and check it out.
I have a vague early 80s memory of a video.
You sound like one of my clients, but okay.
About Happy, I'm really glad you picked this one for one. It's a good song, but there's a point about Keith Richards that I forgot to make 45 minutes ago when we were talking about the band members. And that is, I think Keith Richards is an underrated singer. The songs that he sings, a lot of them are really good. And like he does, you know, guest or supporting vocals on a lot of them.
Oh yeah.
There are a few songs where he's the lead singer and he holds up, and I took note of that actually, from Neil. You probably know it, but there was an episode of The Sopranos that featured the song Through and Through, which was, what album was it? It was the same one with Love is Strange. It was attached.
Voodoo Lounge.
Yeah, Through and Through was on Voodoo Lounge. And I really like that song. And so much so that it was on one of my early lists of this. But noticing that, I was like, oh, this is a Keith song. And then I started actually paying more attention to some of the songs that he sings on. And, you know, he's never going to be on one of those like lists of greats, but I think he is
Amazon
underrated.
Says it is.
Yeah. I think he's underrated for that. So I'm glad that you went with Happy on this.
Yeah. Just to clarify what I was saying earlier about seeing it live, like I by no means have any, I thought it was fun watching him try to sing it. When I mentioned Mick Jagger tried to steal it back from him, that's by no means mean knocking him as a singer. It just means Mick Jagger couldn't help himself from taking back over the microphone.
Tom, Omar, thoughts on the list?
I said what I had to say with Bette Midler.
Okay, fair enough.
I love Honky Tonk Women. It's got one of my favorite guitar riffs out of any of the Stones songs, and I think there's some of Mick's best vocals, to be completely honest with you. I like Keith Richards' vocals on Happy. Happy is one of those songs too, where I can see how they influenced other people down the road, in both blues and like roots rock and things like this. I can hear like a 1988 John Mellencamp singing this song and doing a halfway decent cover of it.
And in a weird way, I can hear the Sex Pistols doing a cover of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
oh, weird, that's good. Yeah. Call, Neil.
Yeah. So it's strange. It kind of, it does have like the Stones have that kind of influence. I'm sorry, Tom, didn't mean.
No. That actually, I had never thought of that. And that is exactly right. And yeah, Beast of Burden's just damn sexy.
Yeah.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention, one of the songs I like, Brown Sugar, I think has one of the best opening guitar riffs of all time. That's such a signature, such a recognizable song. It is admittedly now we consider a controversial song. The Rolling Stones have said that they have cut it from their set list. They won't play it live anymore because of the racist and sexist, not even subtleties. They're overtones of the song. And we're more culturally sensitive to that. And that's not a bad thing. I will, if I got the chance to see them live today, I would miss not hearing that song, but I understand. I get it. So yeah. I'm sympathetic to that. But yeah, phenomenal song. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, round us off. What is your five songs?
Before I get started, Neil, you're right. It was an Acura commercial.
Acura? Wow.
It was okay. Acura. There was also a Sony commercial for the Bravia, and I don't know whether it was a television or something, where a bunch of balls of color are jumping down the street and kind of flooding the screen, because I was Googling Cheese and Rainbow commercials. Before I get to my five, two very quick honorable mention, because these were covers, so I didn't include covers that they did. Mm-hmm. But I do love their cover of Buddy Holly's Not Fade Away.
That rules.
And I'd be remiss if I did not mention their cover of the song Little Red Rooster, which is just amazing. My fifth one is from the album Between the Buttons. It is Miss Amanda Jones. Down and down she goes. Now, I have two reasons for picking this one. One, this was probably the first album cut that I ever heard and kind of committed to memory. Because prior to this, I probably had heard like everything that was on Hot Rocks, or like whatever greatest hits, you know, things you would hear on the radio and you were really hear the radio. And the source for this, me first hearing it, was the John Hughes song, John Hughes movie, Some Kind of Wonderful, because Leah Thompson played a character named Amanda Jones, and it was covered like this halfway decent new age cover by a band called crap. I don't remember.
Joan Osborne.
No, it wasn't Joan Osborne. It was a woman though.
Taylor Swift.
Was she even alive in 1986?
No, she was born in 89.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's right. I should know that. I teach high school students. They all know these things.
They all know. They all have that out.
They would embarrass me so hardcore if they heard me. Okay, so aside from the John Hughes origin of it and everything, I've listened to this a few times, and it strikes me it's very rough, it's very dirty, it's grungy. It's almost like a grungy version of "I Saw Her Standing There" by the Beatles. It has that sort of, except Amanda Jones is a little less innocent than the girl in the McCartney song, but it has that feel to it. And I think it's from right around the same time, maybe a couple of years after it. And I like it because it is a little bit raunchy then, because there are so many songs from the early rock and roll era that are about, here's this girl walking, you know, doo-wah-diddy and all that. Like, girl walking down the street. Here she is. Here's this woman. And this is just, this is way less innocent than that. And I think it's one of those defining pieces that, like, when you talk about how they are a lot more raunchy and sexy in terms of what they're putting out there, I think this is a really good example of that. My fourth one is 19th Nervous Breakdown. Look around. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here comes your 19th nervous breakdown. Don't know if this is on an album, completely honest with you. I think it was issued as a single and maybe put on an album somewhere. So forgive my inaccuracy here. This is a very 60s song to me. It fits in with other songs by around that time, early stuff by like The Who, The Yardbirds, The Animals and things like that. And I just like that about it. I like the lyrics mix singing Here It Comes in a way that sounds very kind of holding something back there. But no, it's honestly like, this was just a song I've always liked. I have no real like kind of analysis of it beyond that. It's just like, I love the sound of it. I love the fact that it fits right in there with that era. And again, it just has that, it has that edge to it. The third one from the album Aftermath, or it's been placed in the album Aftermath in certain distributions, is Paint It Black. Red
sure as I want it painted black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black.
Another movie reference here. The first time I heard this was over the ending credits of the Stanley Kubrick film Full Metal Jacket. And I think a lot of us have.
Yeah.
I can separate it from the film, though. And it is one of my favorite Stones song. It is just like the one I'm going to mention next. It's kind of sinister in a sense. It's dark. It's urgent. I love that. I love the opening riff to the song, that guitar, almost sitar sounding.
Mm-hmm. It is very Eastern sounding.
Yeah, and then the way that the drums
tap tap tap.
And when it cuts into the when it cuts into like the I don't even know if this really has a chorus, but when it cuts into the kind of more normal sounding, I put it, I love that transition as well. And I think this is one of Jagger's like better vocal performances too. My number two is from Beggar's Banquet, Sympathy for the Devil.
I watch with glee while you kings and queens fought for 10 decades for the gods they made. I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys? When after all, it was you and me. Let me please introduce my
This song is ballsy, if I'm being completely honest with you. And I remember a Wayne's World sketch from about 92, 93, maybe, where Mick Jagger was on. And I think Wayne asks, like, do you work for the devil? And Mick's like, yes, my role is purely administrative. Just, that's always stuck with me. But no, this is a ballsy, ballsy song. This is a group that's at the top of their game. I love the steadiness of the beat. I love how it builds and builds and crescendos all just in his lyrics. Especially the line is like, I yell out who shot the Kennedys. And it turns out it was you and me, or and I'm misquoting that slightly, but he just ramps up the vocal in that. And this is really a big vocal performance on him. It really doesn't work without him. It's just essentially a backbeat with some various other rhythm pieces. And my number one is the closer on Let It Bleed, which I want to say has had the most representation on all of our lists tonight.
That's why I said it was the quintessential Rolling Stones album.
Yeah. It's You Can't Always Get What You Want.
I said to him, you can't always get what you want.
I had known this song for years before I watched The Big Chill for the first time, but I love its use of The Big Chill. I actually recently did an episode about The Big Chill with Michael Bailey, so you can go listen to that if you get a chance. This is them, like...
Did you talk about who was cast as the dead body?
Oh, yeah, it's Costner.
Okay, nice.
This is like a shot at the title song. This is them. They're swinging for the fences. They are almost chasing, in their own way, chasing the Beatles with this, but on their terms, or they're chasing Good Vibrations or something. Like, it's in that.
It's an audacious song. It's an audacious concept for a song. It's a sonically audacious song. It says, out of the box, a choice to close an album as a day in the life is on Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah.
But like, they are so skillful and talented and like so disciplined within the song structure, despite like the craziness of, you know, of the sound and the songwriting, that it weirdly works. And like it weirdly fits in thematically with the rest of the album. It's astounding.
And it starts quiet and builds and builds. And whereas A Day in the Life crashes at the end, right? It goes up, 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 yeah. up, 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 boom. And it has that great chord. This just soars and takes off and it never lands. And I think that's exactly what they needed to do with this. And I absolutely love the phrase, you can't always get what you want, but you'll find sometimes you just might find you get what you need. I love that phrase.
It is an uplifting, joyous song.
Yeah.
Coming out of like the ashes of like the most apocalyptic, terrifying subject matter for an album you could ever like ask for. And like even the conceit of the song would seem to be like a compromise in life, right? Like it is, you know, a very clear-minded person would be like, what are they really advocating for in the song? In a sense, it's giving up. It is coming to terms with something. And yet like the song, the gift behind their songwriting acumen is like so strong that like this concept that is essentially like, well, you know, give up, just accept your lot in life. You are jumping up and down and yelling and singing along and screaming. It is like joyous and it gives you this singular rush. It is a neat little trick that only a band as talented as that could pull off.
Yeah. And I think this was 1969, if I'm not mistaken. And that's a pivotal year. It's a year that is, it's not as tumultuous as 68, but it's still, I mean.
But it's a coda. It's a coda to this, like this incredibly dysfunctional, like explosive decade, mm-hmm. like the most dynamic, like cultural decade in American history. And it ends up with like this bitter compromise of just like, we give up. Nixon's the president. We give up.
Yeah.
Like, and you know what I mean? After all this change, I love that song. I think that song embodies the end of the 60s.
Yeah. Well, and also when you consider the 70s is the me decade, right? And things, and the 70s is so much songwriters and, you know, disco later on, of course. And
Coke and Sympathy.
It's Coke. Yeah, exactly. It becomes the you get what you need thing kind of. Is a precursor to that too. It is a really good bridge between the two because everything does come crashing down in like 70 and 71 for a lot of those 60s of that 60s era, and a lot of it has to do with the deaths of very prominent people from that scene. But no, yeah. So that is it. And I wanted to. I'm glad thank you for putting me last. I'm glad we were able to end on this song because I think this is my favorite Stone song. So
it was strategic in my doing that because I did want this one to kind of round out because I do think it is kind of the quintessential, to use that word again, the quintessential closer. Mm-hmm. And it is perfectly chosen as like the end of a movie or the end of an album or whatever. It does have that sense of finality, whether it be grim or uplifting or just resigned or compromised possibly.
Yeah, there are a few other closing tracks that this is up in the top five in my opinion of all time closed album closers.
It's a damn epic song, and mm-hmm. I use that word because of it has this prologue of a choir of like what sounds almost like a children's choir singing the chorus, and then that fades out. And the song, it begins again. That like really, that's not the intro. It is kind of a problem because then we begin, and it, like you're right, the song begins soft. It's acoustic, and there's like this haunting like quality of these in the background, and this sense of resignation. But then like the final 3 minutes when it really really amps up and it's kicking out and it jams, and then like. For a 7.5 minute mark, when it gets to the 7 minute mark for a 7.5 minute song, the last 30 seconds go so hard to use a popular contemporary phrase. When he starts, I don't know if it's like a kick drum snare and the cymbals at the same time, he starts doing like double time on both of them. And that just rides out the last 30 seconds of the song. And it's just so like, it's just like fist pumping the steering wheel when I'm driving listening to this. I mentioned how like I thought like Gimme Shelter would be in contention for their three best Rolling Stone song. I put this one as one of the other three.
Mm-hmm.
It is an incredible. I'm glad all the songs on your list. Yeah, but this one I really wanted us to come down to this one at the very end. So yeah.
Yeah, well, everything you said about You Can't Always Get What You Want is dead on accurate, spot on accurate. I would give a little more love to Sympathy for the Devil, because I think that is also epic in its own way.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And carries a lot of, there was a lot of discovering that song in my parents' bedroom, you know, playing that and like listening and be like, wait a minute, was he talking about? Wait, he's hanging out with Hitler? I'm like, I've heard of that dude, you know, and
it's the alternate history of the world.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah. But it's conceptually, it's super cool.
Yeah.
And again, you know, like it introduces instruments that I wasn't familiar with the Stones playing, you know, it's bongos and yeah. You know, like all kinds of just cool. It's a percussive song.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something, I don't know. And then I just always had this vision of instead of, oh God, who was Michael Dukakis riding the tank?
Yeah,
pictured.
Mick Jagger. No, that is a painful reference.
Yeah, but then I started. But then I pictured Mick Jagger riding the tank through the Russian Square and all this stuff. Like as he sings, you know, I'm like, okay, now I've got something to replace that Michael Dukakis vision.
Why couldn't they have just put Mick Jagger in that ad? Dukakis would have won in a landslide.
So, yeah. Other than that, Tom, I think your list probably. Probably, like I would say, like at least four out of your five would make any one of my top 20 lists of the Stones. So I think that's solid.
Now I'm thinking of John Lovitz doing Michael Dukakis on Saturday Night Live. I am the son of Greek immigrants.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
Yeah, I want to give more love also to Paint It Black. I like the word. I liked how you said it's a sinister sounding song.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the it appearing at the end of Full Metal Jacket, and I'd forgotten about that because I associate it with the song with the movie Stir of Echoes, the Kevin Bacon one that came out when I was in high school, and the song is littered throughout the movie. Like when you watch it, it's like okay, you can't not associate the song because it's very prevalent and it's used in a kind of signature violent song. So I associate it with murder and ghosts and everything. So when you call it a kind of dark and sinister song, it's like, yeah, it has that, it evokes that. And yeah, an all time great opening with that sitar sound and then that tap, tap, tap to the drums, the way it kicks in. So,
yeah.
These are great lists. These are all, I mean, I've because of the delay in when we were recording this, I have been listening to these songs for like 6 months, as well as no kidding, 30 other Rolling Stone songs that have been just playing. So I've had this stuff on my mind. Now I can cleanse once I get this out. Once I get this episode out, I won't listen to them again for 2 or 3 years.
Take me down, little Susie. Take me down.
That brings me to my final kind of question. What is their legacy? How do you think they should be remembered? How do you feel about their longevity? Are they still relevant or did they wear up a long time ago?
Can I go first?
Please, by all means.
I appreciate it. Well, I wanted to attack this question just from a very narrow perspective because I think that they are so big at this point and so ubiquitous and so inextricably linked with like the post-war era of like Western pop culture that it's almost an impossible concept to sum up. So I just want to like encapsulate one tiny aspect of this. And that has to do with like longevity and what that has to do with their legacy. Okay. Because when I think I mentioned as we were introducing the episode, one of the reasons I had sort of initially tuned them out before, you know, I became a grown up was that there was all this ambient noise around them as uncool and old and just kind of desperately hanging on for relevance and just putting out records and going on tour. And like there was these dinosaurs, you know, just on a perpetual, you know, circus tour. And they were all about the glam rock lifestyle, even though they had long since passed the age at which that would be respectable.
So they were
40. And right, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And so I didn't pay attention. And so like when I got into the songs, you know, like when I got into the albums and I went to see them, you know, like I said, I was already in my early and mid 20s. But there was always a part of me that was very self-conscious about liking them, because even though my music friends, my music band friends understood, I always felt a little defensive about it. Like, and Ryan, we did a YouTube podcast last year, and I think I talked a little bit about how I get a lot of shit for liking U2. And so there was always this stigma in my mind that was attached to the Rolling Stones. And listen, I've grown out of that part of it because I've just gotten older, and it's like, who cares? You like what you like. But I have to give credit to two very good friends of mine for really summing up how I view the Stones' longevity and their motivation for continuing, and to me, what their legacy is. And this comes when you strip away the glamour and the artifice and like the football stadiums that they play in, and like all the money that they've made, and you know, their status is like pop culture idols and then fallen heroes and then climbing back to respectability, you know, the rise, the fall, blah, blah, blah. I what these friends of mine really put into context for me was something that I will think about them for the rest of my life. And it will make me forever proud to be a fan of theirs, because like, listen, not everyone is going to be the Beatles. Not everyone was going to put out arguably like 9 or 10 records in like an 8 or 10 year span, whatever the hell it is they did. And then like be able to like leave on top, you know, have that Michael Jordan shot against Utah, although he did come back. So that's a bad analogy, but like, you know what I mean? It's hard to leave on top. And so I always carried that self-consciousness about being a Rolling Stones fan. I mentioned earlier that they got me through that first semester of law school 20 years ago, 21 years ago, which was extremely stressful. And one of the things they did was they bonded me to other classmates of mine in law school. And one of my best friends was someone who was already deeply into the Rolling Stones. And it's my friend Mike and his cousin Rob, both lawyers like me. And you know, if there's anything that's more glamorous than three litigators sitting around talking about like music, this is it. I can't think of it. But one thing they taught me was that I was going through them, like my self-consciousness of like, you know, I love them, but it's just like, it's weird that they're still playing. Why are they a jukebox? Just like shut it down. And like my buddy Rob was just like, hey, like, first of all, let people do what they want to do. Second of all, this conception that they're just doing it for the money, they're just selling out, or they just like they're addicted to the adrenaline high of being a rock star. Maybe that's part of it, but here's why they're doing what they're doing. Here's why they're going to do this until they're dead, because they don't see themselves as like glam rock stars. They don't see themselves as products of the British invasion. They don't see themselves as like hanging on to their AARP card and being like dragged away, kicking and screaming from the stage. They see themselves as, back then it was 4, and I guess now it's 3, but like they see themselves as just a group of like really fucking old African-American musicians hanging out on a street corner playing the blues. That's how they see themselves as. They see themselves as just like 4 black guys playing guitars like on a street corner and just singing randomly. That's their entire self-conception. They came into this world like blues-based. They will leave blues-based, and that is what blues musicians do. They just sit there on the street and they fucking play. And like once that was made clear to me, I just relaxed. I was just like, oh yeah, no, that's exactly who they are. That's exactly what they do. And God bless them for that. And the fact that they can still put out records like A Bigger Bang and Blue and Lonesome, which I really cannot emphasize enough. Everyone go and listen to that covers album from 2016. It basically epitomizes who they are and what they stand for and their whole songwriting ethos. And albums like, you know, this Hackney Diamonds thing, I take my hat off to them. I never want them to stop. I would be happy if they continue to play until like, you know, all their appendages fall off and they die. Just like Charlie did, because that's what they want to do. That's how they conceive of themselves. And when you think of them as blues musicians, just hanging out playing, it makes their entire legacy completely digestible, and it makes their longevity understandable and kind of honorable and like fused with integrity. And I think that's why they belong in the pantheon of, you know, the great songwriters of the last like 50 years. And I think their legacy is like fairly unparalleled. You could say that bands like the Beatles and artists like Bob Dylan like equaled or surpassed them. Like, that's fine. But like, I consider them in the pantheon of like the all-time greats. I'm just so happy that I never got hung up on the legacy question, because those old blues guys on the street corner don't give a shit about legacy. They just play. Oh, but any minute, baby.
all that. I mean, honestly, like, what can I add? That was perfect. There's a couple of things I'd thought of. You know, I did fall into that trap of these are a bunch of old guys who really should hang it up, because I think maybe at some point or another, everybody does. They, among people and for a decent time, especially with me, I think they got taken for granted because they were just there. Yes. And such. But, you know, listening to Hackney Diamonds, especially, it still sounds new. Like, it sounds like the Stones, but it also sounds like it sounds contemporary, and meaning that, like, I can hear more contemporary artists playing some of these things. I'm impressed with the fact that they have Elton John on the album and he just plays the piano. Like, which is like, I think McCartney's on there playing bass at one point or guitar at some point.
Stevie Wonder too.
Yeah. And it's just, there's no like, you know, and you have to listen for it. You know, it's just, yeah, we're just going to get him on to play. And I'm like, it's almost a jam session. And that is impressive to me on the superstar level of the guys hanging out in the corner. But yeah, it's just, they're in the pantheon. They are a fundamental text of rock and roll. If I'm looking at it from the literature teacher point of view, it's like they're the catcher in the rye. It's like there are so many things that come from them that you look at, like you look at everybody from, you look at Zeppelin, you look at Aerosmith that I mentioned a thing, you look at more contemporary people, and I hear the Stones, and I think every single front man since Mick Jagger owes a debt to Mick Jagger. You know, I think he's up there. And I think the other person who fights with him for the title, at least in my mind, is Freddie Mercury. And I think Freddie owes some stuff to Mick too. So, you know, it's just it'll be very sad when they go. Because
I hate to break this to you, but Freddie Mercury's already gone.
No, I know Freddie Mercury's already gone. Yeah, thank you very much. No, when the Stones go, it's going to be sad, but at the same time, they left something behind that they'll just, I don't think they'll ever be reduced to like two songs or something. I think there's just too much out there for that to happen.
My answer to this question would be different if the music wasn't still really good.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the music is still really good. Like the second single from the new album, Sweet Sounds of Heaven with Lady Gaga, which I think I read something. It's like their second collaboration with a female singer since Gimme Shelter, or like to have a female like singer of that caliber on the song or something like that. I was like, that can't be right, but I guess it is. But like, that's a great song. Like, that's a song that she should be proud to put on one of her albums of like her greatest hits or something, like her contribution to that song. Sydney Sweeney's fans should not be ashamed to watch the video for Angry, because that's a good song. That's a good rock song. I went through that period, like in the night when I was getting into them, I was like, okay, I like this band, but
yeah,
probably they, you know, like maybe it was, you know, better to burn out than fade away. You know, it was probably, they probably should have hung it up a long time. And then in like 45 years after they started in 2005, they released another album. I was like, all right, I like this. I like a lot of the songs on this. I guess they can do it. And then, you know, just hearing what I talked about at the beginning, that Marc Maron bit, is there's a courage, there's a bravery of them going on stage and still doing it now when they could be like endangering themselves, when now they might be held to more scrutiny than they did when their whole audience was as drugged out as they were. Neil, final thoughts about it?
Well, it's kind of weird. I feel like this weird sense of kind of like melancholiness right now, as we kind of sum it up, almost like they're gone, like they passed and they haven't. But this conversation is, you know, Omar said some really, really apropos things. And I want to pick up on that, because I've, of all people in the world, you guys know, I've got the biggest Peter Pan complex in the world. Like I tell people when they turn 30, hang it up, you're done. You know, like you like get off the stage. So the fact that, you know, I get the fact where Omar's coming from and thinking like, oh, you know, oh, I don't know if I want to see that. And I liken this to sports references. And I had this conversation with somebody once. Actually, Ryan, you know him. What was his name? Tim Drummond, I think, might have been his name.
Yeah.
The guy that was he plays with Neil Young.
Yeah,
Tim Drummond. Yeah. And he was on like the Neil Young Unplugged on MTV and stuff. I used to hang out with that guy at a bar by us. And he was old and he was playing. And Omar, this kind of, I'm making a point kind of, which kind of aligns with what your friends say now. But this was a point introduced to me back then. We were talking about something about old musicians, and he brought up a reference of like athletes. And he said, the thing about it, he goes, when you're outside looking in, the fan always wants your favorites to leave on top. That's the way you want that memory of them to be. You always think like, oh, it hurts their legacy if they play one game too long and they've lost it. The artists themselves, whether it's an athlete or a musician or an actor or whatever, they don't look at it that way. They don't care if they're still on top at the end. They just want to keep playing. And I kind of thought it, I was like, yeah, you know, I've had this conversation with people about Michael Jordan before, where I was like, oh, I wish he didn't come back to the Wizards. I wish he would have ended with that shot. That would have been better for me. I was me being selfish, saying that's the memory I wish I had. I never once took into account the fact that Michael Jordan didn't care if he won at the end. He just wanted to keep playing. I'm sure he was still competitive, wanted to win, but he didn't need to be a champion. He wanted to play until somebody scraped him off the floor. And that's the thing that I think we forget, or maybe like Omar said, we take for granted or something like that. But yeah, I think we have to stop looking at, you know, the Stones. They're going out there having the fact that they are still playing is awesome. They really do probably want to just keep playing with their friends until they die. No, okay, so the final thing after that, here's an interesting conversation that's a little more of a rhetorical conversation I have with myself all the time. And this is, Tom and Omar, you guys aren't quite aware of this, but Ryan knows this. Like, I've spent the greater part of my adult years going to see really good tribute bands, cover bands of some of the artists that I never got to see in their prime. So I've seen some really, really good, like, you know, like early Bon Scott era AC/DC tributes and stuff, because I never saw that, or Led Zeppelin or something. There are certain eras of music that I never got the chance to see, but the best thing I could do is see a young, really talented cover band or tribute band playing that era with the same kind of energy and verve and swagger as those artists would have. So I've kind of gotten turned on over time too. Now the Stones are out there still playing, obviously, but there's bands like Blackberry Smoke, which is a really, really good kind of Southern rock, kind of Black Crows kind of band that covers the Stones really, really well. And if you watch them, they a little bit of like the band in Almost Famous. Ryan, what was the band in Almost Famous? What were they called?
Stillwater.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say Fever Dog, but that wasn't even the song.
Yeah. But anyway, so I can still kind of relive like some of the Stones' like 60s and 70s era things live if I wanted to, by going to see some of these bands cover them. And I overheard part of a conversation on the radio once with a musical artist who was talking about the future of music. And I thought this was a brilliant concept. I don't think it would actually ever take reality, but it was a brilliant concept. But he said, someday your musical artists will become sports teams, meaning the name and the brand will go on. And every couple of years, they might have a new cast, a new lineup will be playing and all this stuff. And I was like, I don't understand. That wouldn't be possible, because we associate with the members of the band so much. That's what we know. Like, we could never go see the Rolling Stones with five other people somewhere down the line. But what this guy was saying is, you don't think you could, but trust me, 50 years from now, kids that have no idea who the original Rolling Stones members are might be going to see a band play all the Rolling Stones songs. He's like, how is that different than seeing a tribute band or a cover band? And I kind of like put my foot in my mouth with that one, because I was like, well, I actually do go see cover bands and tribute bands all the time, and they dress the part and they, you know, do the makeup and the hair and costumes and stuff. They really are kind of, it's like, I guess it's not that different, really. if they're good, they're good. I'm going there to celebrate the Stones, and I'm celebrating the music of Keith Richards and Mick Jagger and stuff like that. So I just thought that was a really novel kind of concept and something that I struggle with. And I still wonder if that ever really could take hold someday, where bands would become, their brand name would become like a corporate entity, where they would have a draft every couple of years for new players. And if somebody was a better guitar player, they'd replace the person in there, like a sports team. I don't know. But that just got me thinking, like, the long-term future, the fact that the Stones have been doing this for 60 something years. And what if our children and our children's children, if we wanted to introduce them to the band that our dad introduced us to, you know, they would never get to see the actual Stone. Well, Keith Richards would still be around, but the rest of the band wouldn't be here in 50 years. And so it just has me thinking, like, there's, like, they've surpassed, I guess the point I'm trying to make, and I know I'm rambling, the point I'm trying to make is they've surpassed just longevity. They have, like, they're still arguably, I mean, this, I'm going to, after this podcast is over, I'm going to go listen to that last album again, because it's that good. It should be in regularly in my playlist. Like, and that's, these are guys in their 80s. So this is something that they're even through this podcast tonight and talking to you guys about it, I think I've even elevated where they're at on my list. I think I have a deeper respect from hearing you guys talk and appreciate certain things that maybe I hadn't thought of. And there's a lot to be said about this band. And Omar, I'm glad you brought up the thing about kind of, you know, being reticent about how old they are. And maybe it's like a guilty secret to like the Stones. I probably felt that way through my high school and 20s and stuff like that. And I'm glad I don't feel that way now. And I'm glad I appreciate it. And maybe I should have seen them on that final tour in 1997. When
I'm sure there are many other vinyl tours you'll be able to see them on.
exactly. But anyway, so to sum up, I think this was they're absolutely one of the quintessential bands of all time. And one of you said, Ryan, it might have been you, it might have been from early on, even if the band wasn't still around, just their songwriting alone would put them in the top 10 of greatest bands of all time. But the fact that they're still out there doing it is so, you have to kind of, it's okay, that elevates them. You know, there are a whole lot of bands that tried, and whether it be through external issues or internal issues or drugs or murder or alcoholism or just infighting, couldn't last, and these guys did. So I think I've got a new appreciation from them now that I didn't have 3 hours ago.
That sports team concept that you brought up, and the way to sort of keep them everlasting, that might be the only hope for Hall & Oates.
Ooh, too soon, dude. Too soon.
It is kind of the Beach Boys at this point. It's like, who are the Beach Boys? Like Mike Lowe,
no, that's a few guys, point.
John Stamos, and whatever. But it is kind of the Beach Boys, you know, where there's maybe an original member, maybe.
Did not have John Stamos coming up on this podcast on my bingo card.
What were you paying attention to then? All right. Okay. But we are going to get out of here, but I do have one more. I have a secret question, that I withheld. I held back, and I only want you to think about, I don't want you to overthink this. That's why I didn't ask in advance. I want you to give your answer in 5 seconds. We've talked a lot about movie soundtracks and their appearances. So what Rolling Stones song would you play during would you have play during the ending credits of your movie, your biopic? What Stone songs would you have playing during the ending credits of your movie, Tom?
Oh, fuck.
I know. I didn't want you to overthink it.
Oh, God. The first song that came into my mind was You Can't Always Get What You Want, which is the total cliche answer to this.
Well, that's what kind of movie you're going to have.
That's what I'm going to go with. Yeah.
Omar.
Factory Girl.
Neil.
Bitch.
I'll go classy and say Shine a Light. Okay. All right.
Good question, man. That was fun.
Didn't
see that coming.
Thanks all of you out there. Omar, Neil, you guys both make regular appearances on the show. Tom, you've got your own podcast outlet, so let our listeners know where else they can hear you.
Yeah, Pop Culture Affidavit, which you can find at popcultureaffidavit.com. That's everything random in the world of popular culture. And there's Required Reading with Tom and Stella, the literature and book podcast that I host with Stella. And that's both of those are over at the Two True Freaks podcast network.
cool. Very much. And yeah, Neil, Omar, Tom, thank all three of you. I'm going to have you guys again later on this year. We'll come back to some more good music that we can talk about. But for now, folks, Fire & Water Records is a proud part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Feedback for this show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com, as well as the Facebook page for Fire & Water Records. Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For more information on how you can support the Fire & Water Network, visit patreon.com/FWPodcasts. All music clips and quoted lyrics are used for entertainment purposes. Please support the artists and their work by purchasing or downloading the songs legally. Thanks for listening. Take us away, guys. Yeah.